Hey, let's start the show.
It's July 28th, 2011. Welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of Tested.com. I'm Will Smith. Joining me today, sitting across the table as always, back from Comic-Con. Norman Chan.
I wasn't part of last week's podcast. I heard it was the worst podcast ever.
You know, the feedback was really positive. People liked the BMW show featuring Brad Shoemaker from Giant Bomb, Matt Braga from Tested, and myself.
And we had to deport one of them, so yeah, that shows how good he was.
Well, Braga is back in Canada, but taking his seat, sitting to my left, Lloyd Case. How you doing, Lloyd?
Hey, good to be here.
Lloyd is a frequent contributor. You've seen his bylines at least, twice a month, I guess?
Roughly.
Yeah, more or less.
Plus or minus. I owe you something, Norm. I'll get that soon. Promise.
with the long-term testing column, basically, is what you're doing. Living with tech. And Lloyd, you may know Lloyd from, Maximum PC and Extreme Tech and tons of other publications around the web. So we're glad to have you here, Lloyd.
Yeah, fun to be here. I'm here for a reason, not just to be on this podcast.
Yeah, the mission. Lloyd clearly knows the tangent nature. We're going to have kimchi burritos after the show. So
this is why. Yeah, we typically have podcasts then lunch. The podcast, we realize doing podcasts after lunch is a bad idea.
Go to sleep.
Everyone's tired, and podcasts before lunch, then we are hungry and we get to talk about food and makes interesting podcast discussion.
Right. Well, and there's time pressure to like keep it moving. If we're before lunch, because everybody wants to get out and get done.
Yeah, but we'll find a way to drag it out for 2+ hours anyway. So today is Kimchi Burritos, John's Deli down on Battery Street by Market. It's famous. I think
it's
one of the few places on Yelp where it's like 5 stars, 4.5 stars, $1 sign, and like 700 reviews or something.
Yeah, and it's universally positive. I'm not even a huge kimchi fan, and I like the kimchi burrito quite a bit. And it comes in incredibly varying spicinesses.
Yes, so. Basically normal kimchi or the suicide kimchi. Even Joey Familiar, our video producer, who loves hot sauce, he felt very uncomfortable after he's
done it twice.
He's done it twice and he's regretted it each time. They have a food challenge.
Yeah, couple of food challenges. I'm not interested.
They had the 7-pound burrito challenge. If you can eat 7 pounds of their suicide burrito with no water,
that's
free
gross.
Burritos for a year.
When I was 20, I got into a chili dog eating contest with my uncle who weighs 240 pounds.
Oh boy!
And we tied, and that was the last eating contest I ever took part in.
Oh my god!
Well, the thing after watching Dan Stapleton and Norm at PC Gamer have a Jack in the Box eating contest one time,
Bacon Ultimate Cheeseburger,
right? Bacon Ultimate Cheeseburger.
I got through 2.5.
I learned. And the milkshakes.
And a Oreo milkshake.
Yeah. The thing I learned was that in an eating contest, everybody loses.
Yeah, Dan did not eat for an entire 24 hours after that.
Right. He was like a snake. It was really gross. It was just watching them look at the food as they were bringing it up to their mouths, just trying. Norm's urge to win was
– It was there for support, moral support.
It was
so
gross.
He got the five.
So gross.
Five Bacon Ultimate Cheeseburgers.
Well, there's a guy in San Jose that just won the hot dog eating contest.
Oh, Joey Chestnut.
60 hot dogs?
Joey, he's a gross. Bay Area hero. He's beaten, what's the guy's name, Kobayashi many, many years in a row. He wins the New York Coney Island eating contest every year.
I mean, the day that you guys ate the Jack in the Box sandwiches, I think you ate probably 4,000 calories worth of sandwich and shake.
Oh, it's like 1,000 calories per burger.
Yeah, it was really gross.
Yeah.
Don't do that. Don't have eating contests at home. It's not a good idea.
Well, that's why that show, Man vs. Food, is such a
bad idea. I don't watch
that.
I don't want to support that.
Yeah, that guy is not going to live very long if he keeps on doing it. That's why he has a spinoff show where he gets other people to compete for him.
Was he the guy that went to that fall place in New York? The place where they have the respirators when they're making
I don't know if
food.
He had to do that, but he's had hot food before. Yeah, hot food. The trick is for eating milk, and also just you get sick of the flavors. No matter what you eat, if it's a lot of food, you just got to mix it up by drinking something or having sauces so you don't have the same flavor, especially like oysters. Yeah.
Well, there was a time I was at a PR event for AMD, and legendary AMD PR guy Chris Hook, who most of us know, passed out from eating too much hot food. And they actually had to take him to the hospital and pump his stomach.
Wow. I'll have to give Chris some grief. I didn't know that. So anyway, kind of an interesting news this week. It's not a huge tech news week, I would say. But first thing is, the big story today is Nintendo has dropped the price on the 3DS pretty dramatically. It launched at $250. They're dropping it to $170? $169?
That's like a third, isn't it? Isn't that like a third?
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's. I think that's a... I think had they launched at that price, I think it would have been a much, you know, I think they've sold like 800,000 of them so far. But I think
– oh, God. It's more than a third. 68%
well,
price.
So that's a third.
Yeah.
Okay. We're editors.
Yeah. Not Matt.
I'm a Hufflepuff. I mean it's – the interesting thing is to kind of as a make good. So the whole deal is they're dropping the price. It's effective 1st of August, August 15th, something
like
that.
August
10th.
That must have been why it disappeared off Amazon. Remember those things somebody said, you can't order it for Amazon anymore.
That seemed to me like it was an algorithm thing. You know, Amazon has – that's one of those products that people were doing the negative review bomb on.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, sometimes when products get a certain number of negative reviews or crosses a threshold or something, the algorithm just pulls it. And I think that's probably – I mean that's my hunch. I don't think they ever actually said – they just said it was a bug on someone's
side. To be fair, it's sold 3.6 million lifetime.
The 3DS?
Yeah. It's 700,000 for the recent quarter.
Oh, okay. So
worldwide.
So that, I mean, that's not an unsuccessful launch.
If they launched it and only sold 700,000,
yeah,
that would be very bad.
From the way the press release was written, it read like they'd sold 843,000.
The quarter.
Okay, so I missed an important prepositional phrase there. As a make good for people who bought it at the $250 price, they're giving you 20 free games.
3DS games.
3DS
games.
Well,
No.
There aren't 20 3DS games at this point, are there, that you'd want to play? I don't think.
No, there are not.
They're doing downloadable games. So it's GBA games and NES games, it looks like. But it's a pretty good list. It's like Yoshi's Island and, classic Nintendo games.
Some of the games are not even going to sell. You only can get it.
Well, that's what they're saying now.
If you bought the 3DS early.
Yeah, so the way you get access to the games is if you buy the games, if you connect to the eShop before a cutoff date, I think it was August 11th or something like that, then you'll get access to 20 downloadable games. You don't get to choose the games. They haven't announced all of the games. It seems like, you know, even if they're selling those games for $5 a pop, it's a pretty good deal.
What's to stop someone from buying a 3DS now and getting a 30-day, you know, price match guarantee from Best Buy?
It's unclear whether it's tied to hardware or your eShop account. Your Nintendo World account, whatever the...
So what's to stop someone from buying one now and then go to Best Buy and say, hey, the price drop.
Yeah, I think the thing to do is to buy it from Best Buy where there's a price match.
It's a classic Circuit City commercial, right? The kid goes up to the counter, I bought this, and then today I saw this, and then the lady hands him the change at the counter.
37 cents back?
Yeah, actual cash. It's like, wow, price matching.
Okay.
It's a famous commercial. You can look it up on YouTube.
As a complete aside, since you said Circuit City, you heard the story about how Circuit City got its start, right?
No.
Oh, I don't remember the founder's name, but he started back in, I believe, the late 50s, early 60s.
Okay.
And back in the day when television was a new thing, it might have been color TV. I don't remember the exact date.
Okay.
Anyway, he would go around and say, I'll loan you this TV for a couple of weeks. You can check it out with your family and see if they like it. And he'd call every single day and say what shows you're watching and kind of keep a record of it. And then he would call back just when the kid's favorite show is on and said, I'm coming to pick up the TV now.
Oh, that's brutal. So it was like rent. It was like borrow to own.
Right.
Wow. And this is why door-to-door salesmen no longer nobody answers the door when the Fuller Brush guy's at the door, right? So that's just evil. Angry kids. Is this good? I mean, is this good for Nintendo or bad for Nintendo?
I think it's good for Nintendo fans.
It's a consumer-friendly move.
Yeah.
Have to contrast this with, you know, in a similar situation, how Nintendo is handling this, which, you know, is obviously was a problem, right? Maybe even – probably not of debacle proportions, but a big problem for them because it wasn't moving like they expected.
Right.
Versus how Sony might have handled it, which is sort of to, you know, bury their heads in the sand.
Well, they would have told you to start saving earlier.
Right.
Yeah.
So
– although I think they've moved beyond that at this point. I think they learned an important lesson from the PS3 launch. Although are they going to be able? It seems like they're not going to be able to reduce the price on the Vita to match.
The Vita, the hardware is pretty intense. I mean, the $249 price on the Vita. Patrick's saying they only got there because they cut RAM.
Right. So they made hardware cuts in order to be competitive with the $250 3DS, and now they're not competitive with the 170.
But we assume they're still making money on hardware. It's
Nintendo.
Yeah.
There was actually a report from a Japanese financial publication said they're probably not actually making money on hardware at this point.
Oh.
But, you know, one of the things that as I've gotten older, I've realized is that the companies that are really successful look at how costs are going to reduce over a period of time. And even if they're losing a little bit of money now, in 6 months, they'll probably be making money just because of the economies of scale, assuming this increases sales.
Have you guys seen 3DSs in the wild?
I have. Yeah, I saw a bunch at WonderCon.
Okay. Outside of gatherings of nerds.
I occasionally see one on BART. But
I've seen more DS Fats on BART than 3DS from like middle-aged women.
So the ratio of the things I see most of are Kindle, like third-gen Kindles. I see tons of third-gen Kindles on the train.
Absolutely.
I guess the thing I see most is smartphones, and then it's third-gen Kindles, and then occasionally you'll see some lunatic with his iPad out. And then it's like
there's 3DS, nothing wrong with having an iPad out on
the BART.
Yeah, nothing wrong with that.
It's not necessary. Use your phone. Really, you would take your iPad out on BART?
Sure.
For a 20-minute ride?
40-minute ride.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you ride BART that often?
I ride Muni every day.
Do you take your iPad out on Muni?
Sometimes, yeah.
Really?
Yeah. On the bus? Really?
On the bus, yeah.
When you're standing?
No, not when I'm standing. When I'm sitting.
Oh, I guess you live far enough out that you get a seat.
I get a seat.
See, I always have to stand.
Oh, no, when you're standing, it's too heavy.
Yeah, it's dopey. It's not a comfortable experience.
I have to give some props to Amazon, by the way. My Kindle 3 died. The display kind of got suddenly corrupted. And I called them up, and I didn't even know. It turned out that my warranty hadn't expired, but I didn't even know that. And the person on the other end didn't answer my question, just said, oh, we'll send you a new one. And they sent me a new one.
And they cross-ship them, too.
Right, yeah. Right. It was beautiful. I had one a couple of days and was back in action.
Yeah, I had a similar problem. I don't know if you remember, but the Kindle 2, the second-gen Kindle, if you dropped it on a specific corner, pretty much it was an immediate death sentence for that. So I think it was the top right, but it may have been the top left. And I dropped it, and it was in a case, but it hit just kind of on the right spot, and it killed it. So I called them, and same thing. Mine was out of warranty. They said, "Oh yeah, we'll totally replace it. Send it back."
That's smart because they know they're making money on the books, you know.
Well, they're selling razors, not right. Books.
Well, they're making money on the books, but also they don't determine the price for the books.
Not anymore.
Yeah, publishers determine the price of the books, right. And that ties into one story.
Was that a perfect segue?
Perfect segue.
Well, it wasn't for the one that's next on the list.
Is it even on the list?
No.
I don't know. Amazon changing the iOS app.
When I went down the list of stories on the list, you didn't say anything about that, so I didn't add it to the list.
Well, that's why it was a perfect segue.
So it's not on the list.
Nope, not on the list.
But yeah, Amazon, Barnes & Noble both updated their Nook and – well, Kindle and Nook apps respectively this week. The store buttons are gone.
Right.
So guys, in order to buy books and send them to your iPad or Kindle or iPad or iPhone from Kindle or Nook Store – you have to go to the web browser now and log in.
Yeah. No, you have to buy it. There's no even link to a web browser.
You have to go to open up Safari and go to www.amazon.com/Kindle Store or barnesandnoble.com/.
Browse there, tied to your account, and then it will sync. Yes.
Well, it's just like buying it from the web. Yeah. It's just like buying from your
PC. It is buying it from the web.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is what the only difference here is that it used to be that there was a button that would automatically log you in based on the credentials in the app, and you'd be there. But
then they'd have to give Apple a cut, right?
Right. That was the
deal. This way they don't have to do that.
Maybe. Mm-hmm. It's unclear. It's
30% cut.
Yeah. It would be basically their entire cut given the terms of the Apple developer restrictions on this stuff now. So I mean, I kind of feel like there's probably somebody out there who will suddenly not know how to buy books from their Kindle app now or for their Kindle app now. But do you guys actually buy books when I'm buying books, I usually am sitting on a desk at work and somebody sends me a link to a book that I'm going to read and I hit the button and it's there.
I would say out of all the books on my Kindle, like two or three of them I bought off the Kindle and the vast majority have been off the web.
Yeah, just because the Kindle experience – If you're sitting on the airplane, you're getting ready to take off, you're like, oh, man, I don't have anything to read. I just finished my book. That's the only time I've ever used the Kindle app, the Kindle itself to buy a book.
Yeah.
So
– I mean, they're not even using iTunes. I mean, it's pretty asinine on Apple's part. But what would be a reasonable cut?
I don't think there is a reasonable cut for that.
It's a direct competitor with iBooks.
I don't care. I mean, I'm a normal schmo. I don't care that they're competing with Apple's crappier service.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the touchpad brought this in sharp relief. When the touchpad launched and I brought it home to review and there was no Kindle app, that's a solid 10 or 15% of the use that I get out of the iPad right now is reading books. So without
– You're saying that because people love Kindle, Amazon is helping sell iPads.
Amazon is adding value to that platform.
If Amazon took Kindle off of iPad, would that affect iPad sales?
iPad is much less valuable to me as a user. I would be much less likely to buy a new iPad in the future. I mean, it's you know, it's literally my – the things I use the iPad for are reading books, reading web – like long web stories. I'll frequently Instapaper something and for example, the thing about carbs that was in the New York Times magazine 10 years ago, somebody had sent me a link to it. So I read that and it was 4,000 words. It's perfect for reading on a tablet rather than sitting in front of a computer. And checking Twitter and email. Those are really the only things I use.
Well, it's interesting because I think Apple is still struggling with what its business model is. Its business model is still selling hardware, right? Mm-hmm. And even though it's making money off content, it hasn't sort of transitioned to being a content provider primarily. Whereas, you know, Amazon's clearly a company that sells content, and they understand that. That's why Kindle is everywhere, right?
Right.
Well,
right.
Not just content, but, I mean, they make a lot of money off iTunes. And they
well,
are,
do they
are,
though? I mean, for a long time they did.
Apps and music, they make a lot of money. I mean,
well,
compared to hardware,
make money on.
Not that much, but it's a big part of their business.
Yeah, I mean, the benefit for them of having control over that stuff is that it locks people into their hardware platforms.
That's right.
Not the other way around.
Right.
I mean, just because whether they make money on music or not, because – well, music is a bad example. Whether they make money on movies or not, people who buy movies from iTunes are less likely to buy an Android or WebOS or Windows Phone 7 phone because the content that they spent money on won't work on the new platforms.
That's right.
So they're stuck. Same thing for iBooks. The smartest thing that Apple could do is to make iBooks apps for Android and Windows and Mac and put that out there so that it's another way to pull people in like iTunes. This is actually one of the questions I didn't use today because the audio quality was kind of bad. It was from a user who said, you know, hey, does the fact that iTunes is really a terrible piece of software on Windows, you know, is Apple shooting themselves in the foot because Windows users who their only exposure to Mac PC desktop software is iTunes for Windows.
Right. We hear these wonderful things about how great the user experience is on Mac, but we have this iTunes thing where the user experience is crap.
It's
I don't think Apple cares.
Slow and crashy.
They want people to buy off their phones and iPads.
Yeah, well, and it seems like – I mean, I don't know how much you've used iOS 5 at this point, Lloyd, but it seems like they're moving away from a syncing model entirely. Like the further – the next version of iOS after iOS 5, I would be surprised if you require – if you have to connect anything to iTunes at all. iTunes just doesn't become a web store at some point in the future.
Right.
Anyway, so yeah, that's that stuff. Mango, speaking of phones, Mango RTM'd earlier this week.
Yep.
So that doesn't mean that it's going to be available for your Windows Phone 7 phones next week. It means that it is going now to manufacturers, and then after that, it'll go to carriers. So sometime in the fall.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of testing they all have to do to make sure everything works right.
Yeah, and they want to add their own crapware onto the onto the phones.
Now, what new features are we talking here?
So we did some quick looks at this a few weeks ago. A lot of it is UI stuff. So they're first off, multitasking. So Twitter app and stuff like that can run in the background, which is a good thing. It seems like it's API assisted multitasking for the most part, similar to iOS. Rather than Android or WebOS or BlackBerry, QNX, whatever. The live tiles are more live. They're adding the ability to group users together, so independent of any kind of any communications medium. So, for example, I could make a podcast group, and it would be you and Norm and me and Gary and whoever else. And then when I open that group up, I can send messages to them.
Oh, okay.
That are in, it's almost like a mailing list, like a phone side mailing list. But
like
it'll
Google
work
Plus.
With, kind of, yeah. But this works with SMS, MMS, email, live, whatever IM clients they support. I think they support Live Messenger and Yahoo, but not Jabber or AIM. And I mean, it's kind of an interesting hook. They're adding a Twitter support, direct Twitter support for the contacts app. The way it's the way it's kind of synchronized with Facebook now, you can also add the same level of synchronization to Twitter.
Yeah, my wife has a Windows 7 phone, so
does she like it?
So far, I mean, she finds the UI a little bit clunky.
Yeah,
but she's actually coming from a feature phone, so it's really funny. She said, oh, I'll never use it for data. And now she uses it for data all the time.
Well, that's the thing that everybody – it happens to everybody when they get a smartphone for the first time, right?
is I don't want a data plan. I'm just going to do text message and
right.
maybe email.
And then the Wi-Fi. First time you try to do something without Wi-Fi, you're like, oh, okay, maybe I do. Checking Twitter is good or whatever. Facebook.
Well, it's really funny. My daughter went to a semester abroad in Germany, right? Mm-hmm. So she just bought a feature phone because she's only going to be there for a few months.
Right.
And she says, my phone doesn't even have a display on the front. I said, what do you mean? And I realized that even the first phone she ever got had a little status display on the front when the cover was folded.
Oh, wow.
And this
phones,
one
yeah.
doesn't even have that. No camera. It's just a pay-as-you-go basic phone. It's
oh, wow.
funny.
That was the best thing ever, those old Samsung phones.
You could see the number
the
without opening.
Right.
Yeah. The number and the time.
Yeah. I like Windows Phone 7. I think it's a pretty good platform. I think that they have really managed the UI experience much better than Google has with Android, even though that's a much more mature product at this point, just because all those annoying hitches that kind of plague many Android phones that I've used aren't present on the
I think also Microsoft did the right thing in terms of saying these are the hardware requirements as opposed to making it too variable.
I mean,
that was very, very strict, though.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's there's one,
and what that did was also it made the different versions of the phones, like the ways manufacturers could differentiate and innovate, mm-hmm. weren't actually very good.
Right. Well,
HTC Surround.
I think that the manufacturers chose gimmicks rather than differentiating with good design and stuff like that. I think the best of the first wave of Windows Phone 7 phones was the Samsung Focus. At least for the ones we tested, just because it was just a plain phone. There was no weird side slide keyboard. The other thing Microsoft did really well was the keyboard, is the soft keyboard that's, I think, best in class.
Mm-hmm.
I'm excited to see. We have a developer phone here that we've spent some time with. And, of course, the Zune stuff is a pretty compelling music service if you're into paying for music services. Although, again, this is another one of those situations where had Microsoft released a Zune client for iOS and Android, then they would have a much larger installed base of Zune customers.
Do you think that Apple would have let a Zune client onto iOS?
I think it would be very difficult for Apple to not let a Zune client onto iOS if they
just
want.
Like Spotify and Audio Client.
Yeah, I mean, it's. I think Apple would not have wanted to let a Zune client on, but I think, you know, given the choice of that or some giant anti-competitive investigation from the Department of Justice, I think they'd probably grit their teeth and press the accept button.
Right.
Smartphone market share. This is Nielsen released an enormous report this morning. Basically, they broke down smartphone market share by OS and then by vendor. By OS and then vendor in each OS. Of course, the no surprises, really. Android as an OS has a larger market share than anyone else, 39% versus iOS's 28% and RIM's, I think, 20%, something around there. WinPhone 7 chalked in at about 9% of the overall market share. WebOS and Symbian were both bringing up the rear with 2%. The interesting thing in this was that what do you think the most popular Android handset manufacturer is?
Motorola?
Samsung.
HTC.
Popular?
Most of the largest percentage of Android handsets, according to this Nielsen survey, is HTC.
Hmm.
And then most popular Samsung? Windows Phone 7 handsets?
HTC.
HTC again, yeah. So they're selling more. This is in the US only. So obviously, if you factor in Europe, then Symbian's going to go up and different parts of the world. I thought this was really interesting. I was not. I would have expected Samsung in the Windows.
Well, you
Phone
know,
7
I could believe that. HTC's only Android manufacturer really pushing like their brand out. I mean, the billboards.
Well, Motorola does too.
I guess Motorola.
Well, what's interesting is like, for example, I have a Droid X, right?
Uh huh.
And so I get this little magazine that Verizon sent out called Droid, and you open it up, and it's not just Motorola phones. It's all
well, it's all their Droid branded phones, right?
So I thought that was kind of
interesting. Because it's a Verizon thing,
right?
Well, Droid is a Verizon brand
license from Lucas,
right? But I mean, there have been Motorola, Samsung, and HTC phones with the Droid brand. Because I mean, the HTC phone was the Aeris, which wasn't a particularly good
Incredible.
Phone. I guess the Incredible too, yeah. But the Samsung phone was a Galaxy. Hold on, no, they branded their Galaxy S phone. It was just. See, this is the thing that confuses me about Verizon is why are they branding some phones Droid and some phones are just manufacturers' brands? It kind of makes no sense in a lot of ways. But anyway, so yeah, market share. There's a story on Tested Up by the time you hear this that runs down the whole thing. iOS – iPhone is the most popular single handset because it's the you know, it's the only iOS device, and they have 27 or 28% of market share or something like that in the U.S.
What I liked was some stat that I read recently where it's 33% – so 33% of users surveyed who had never seen or used an Apple product would buy an iPhone 5 when it came out.
Yeah, with sight unseen.
Sight unseen.
Yeah. You mean among people who've never owned an Apple product before.
Right.
Yeah, I mean they have – well, this is the thing that Marco Arment said a while ago too, that there's not really a tablet market right now. There's just an iPad market. And the smartphone situation is a little different just because of the AT. I think only because of AT&T exclusivity for that initial period. Had Apple not done an AT&T exclusive agreement, I think the U.S. smartphone market would be very different now.
Yeah, that comment about tablets is interesting because I know for example, that Asus is selling a ton of those
Transformers.
Right.
Yeah.
And a ton is relative to what Asus would sell, but it's still a drop in the bucket relative to iPads.
Right, compared to the 20 million or something iPad 2s they've sold so far. I mean, that you think about that. That is a product category that didn't exist last February, and they released a product and in 6 months have sold 20 million units and really have no significant competition at this point. I mean, that's going to change over time, but the tablet manufacturers have built an uphill battle for themselves out of this. Tablets, Ray Sonora, our friend over at DisplayMate, and I think probably the internet's leading expert on LCD displays, did a comparison of tablet panels. And his results always are really scary and technical and kind of interesting. The short version is that he likes the iPad 2 display. Despite some problems. I mean, I don't know if you've used – how much you've used it, but I know you've noticed the backlight bleed-through problem.
A little bit, yeah.
I definitely see it on mine when I'm watching full-screen movies and stuff like that. But it's a pretty good display. I mean, off-axis is really nice. It's a good-looking panel. The first runner-up and the best of the Android tablets was the Galaxy Tab 10.1.
Now, both those are IPS panels, right?
Both of those are IPS panels. And the Galaxy Tab is a gorgeous. We didn't actually review one just because when you get into these devices and it's like reviewing video. I mean, you've reviewed video cards for a long time, Lloyd.
Right.
It becomes kind of difficult to differentiate when you're looking at essentially the same hardware with a different plastic shell around or a different label on the box.
No, with the Galaxy Tab, the new one, we're waiting for the smaller version,
the 8.9.
Right. Yeah,
yeah. But yeah, and then down the list, the Zoom and some of the other tablets are increasingly poor displays. And Motorola especially, both on the Atrix and on the Zoom, I think they really cheaped out on the displays because they're bad TFT panels with off-axis and kind of soft colors.
TN panels, you mean?
TN panels, yeah. Sorry. And don't look – I mean, they just don't look good.
Right. You know, it's interesting, Apple's reaction to any kind of competition, it's like they treat competition – almost as an insult in some respects. And so this whole bit about how they're looking for alternate suppliers for some of their chip stuff instead of Samsung because Samsung's getting into their markets is kind of an interesting reaction because they're different divisions and, you know, the whole bit. But
well, Samsung's an enormous company.
Right.
I mean, it's just there's a us or them mentality at Apple that's sometimes a little – I wonder how much
of it's – But they welcome competition. They welcome it. Well, on paper,
yeah, of course. When the Justice Department comes calling, they welcome it. I mean, what do you think about all the Samsung? The Samsung. We've talked about this a lot, but I'd be interested to hear what you think about the Samsung Apple stuff. It seems like patent portfolio grandstanding to me is kind of where we ended up.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure where it's going to go because you know the whole issue with patents in general, of course, ignoring the problem patent trolls, which is a different issue entirely.
Right.
But the whole cross-licensing thing between all these different companies, you know, like the fact that all these – like HTC pays Microsoft a royalty for every Android product they sell, right? Stuff like that. I mean, there's a lot of that that's been going on for years and years, and people don't realize that. I mean, HP, for example, I know gets a ton of royalties just from a lot of different companies on stuff that they own patents for and pays out a lot of royalties to essentially the same companies because of all this cross-licensing stuff they do. And sometimes they cross license so that they don't have to pay royalties, but there's still agreements.
Right. Here's our portfolio. We want access to your portfolio.
Right.
And we're not going to trade money, but
right.
I
think to some extent, particularly with things like software patents, I mean, it's still an illustration of how the patent system is a little bit broken. Right.
Oh, yeah. I'd say it's more than a little bit. Yeah. I mean, the whole idea we'll approve everything and let the courts figure out what's legit and what isn't is
right.
fundamentally broken.
And it's all been gentlemen's agreement until these patent troll companies started to exist. And you could say that it was broken under the hood and nobody really cared until all these patent trolls surfaced and one-man shops started suing everybody in sight.
Right. Well, and a lot of that started with Rambus, really. I mean, if you look – like that was the first one of these big patent – and not to say Rambus is a patent troll because they actually released products for a fairly significant period of time.
Right. And they still do actually.
Right. Yeah. Of course. But I mean that was the first – hey, your IP is violating us. We're going to shut down your entire product line
right.
unless you pony up, and then everybody ponied up. So, Lion's out.
I'm using Lion right now,
even as we speak. It's good to see your focus on the podcast.
Yeah, I got rid of the iPad. I haven't used the iPad since I got this.
How's the Transformer doing? Are you still testing that out?
Still have the Transformer.
Okay,
still using that for bed.
Okay.
Bed computing, couch computing.
Have you had freezing? There have been reports. There have been a couple of problems with Lion that have come out over the last week since it was released. But the big one that we're hearing a lot about is people with 2011 era iMacs, the most recent refresh, having freezing problems.
Upgrading
the Lion, having freezing problems that seem to be centered around video playback. Or Flash or H.264. It's unclear exactly what the trigger is.
Yeah, it's a long forum thread in Apple's support page.
It seems to be restricted to the desktop platforms, MacBooks, right?
Well, so I've had some freezing. I actually had the first freeze I've seen so far on my 2009 MacBook 13-inch MacBook Pro this morning. But that didn't seem to be the same thing that they were reporting. It seems like it was just some random hiccup. It seems to be iMacs. It seems to be 2011 iMacs. So Thunderbolt equipped. Basically, Sandy Bridge IMAX, and not the January 2011 MacBook Pros.
Okay,
so nobody knows what it is. You say it's a big thread. It's 250. When I looked, it was like 250, 300 posts, which is a big forum thread.
Means it's real. It's not just one or two people.
But you know, how many of those IMAX did they sell? So it's unclear how many people it's actually affecting in the real world. And of course, as is typical, there's no response from Apple. So. I would expect, given just kind of the general – there's been a lot of weird bugs that I've experienced. We can talk about this in a little bit or we can do it now. But just window management issues where when you're migrating from space to space, the desktop icons pop up after the transition happens. Windows coming to the foreground or going to the background kind of unexpectedly through
no action of mine. Also, like, depending on what – you know, different programs manage windows differently, like Office, like Excel and Photoshop. They have like their own system windows. So if you – move them to spaces, Line doesn't know what to do with that.
Yeah, so you leave what do the toolboxes stay on the old spaces?
I think I'm not sure exactly how like the mission control manages those windows.
Okay.
Yeah. Adobe in particular seems to have their own version of windowing on everything.
Yeah.
And it's a royal pain a lot of the time.
Well, Adobe the Adobe apps are the perfect case study for things that should work in full screen with Lion out of the box. And of course, whether Adobe actually supports that with CS5 remains to be seen. I mean, I don't know what the status of CS6 is. I don't even know if they've started talking about that yet. But I guess CS5 came out more than a year ago now.
5.5 is out now.
Yeah. So, but their whole kind of desktop inside the app metaphor seems like a good fit for full screen. For full screen mode, whether they support it, we'll see.
Well, I use Photoshop and Premiere Pro quite a lot, so and it works well. But every now and then, I'll go to like Windows keys to do things like Alt FS to save, right?
Mm-hmm.
And instead, it does something else.
Yeah, well, their keyboard shortcuts have always been kind of jacked, though. So Lion problems reported all around, basically. Galaxy S2. Confirmed in U.S. for August. It's been out in Europe and other areas for a while.
August 15th is what everyone's saying.
So this is. I mean, we've talked about the Galaxy S1 for a lot. I'm not going to go back into that and trudge down that path again. But these are dual core Cortex A9 1.2 gigahertz phones. Same resolution as the old ones. Presumably using Samsung's AMOLED screens, which
really,
are
really
nice.
Right. Big screens. It is a really light phone.
Super thin, like the Infuse.
Yeah.
So I'm curious about the whole concept of like dual core on a phone. Do people actually have performance problems with their phones?
Well, you use an Android phone, right?
Yeah, I got a Droid X. I use it at home mostly.
So the problems I've had are the stuttering and the inconsistent stuff, not the actual.
Even when there's a bunch of apps running in the background and stuff, I haven't noticed any sluggishness like on doing normal stuff.
For me, it's usually that there's the thing that I always notice is that you'll move something and there'll be a 3 second hang or a 3 millisecond hang rather.
Right.
So you try to swipe into a different app or you launch something and it just kind of does the whole phone hangs for a minuscule period of time. Frequently, that's not CPU speed, that's memory management or some other or just a bad app running in the background. Considering that a lot of phones have been launching with dual cores and versions of Android that don't really work with multiple core CPUs, it's been a little bit weird. These are all going to launch with Gingerbread. So in theory, they should be able to take advantage of the multiple core support.
Okay.
I wonder if there's also some power management savings by running, you know, if I'm sure that I don't know, they don't really talk about specifics of ARM architecture, at least to us. So I'm curious about how if there's a turbo boost speed step analog of what we see on the desktop and mobile CPU sides with these things where they're running multiple cores at lower speeds and things like
that. The 1.2 gigahertz infused single core had no UI problems.
It was fantastic. Yeah, it was super, super, super fast. Didn't have the hitching problems. It launched with Froyo though. So, you know, this is the fundamental problem I have with Android is that – yeah, there's better software out there, and companies are releasing phones.
And even with Tegra 2, I mean, yes, it was dual core, but a lot of that performance increase was in the graphics side, and that's why you can do the HDMI out, the mirroring.
Well, that was all just baked into hardware, so there's no performance penalty for HDMI mirroring. I don't know. I think that the first wave of Galaxy S phones were pretty bad. They did dopey things like
TouchWiz.
Well, TouchWiz is bad, but the worst thing was using the wrong file system on key partitions so that if one app was accessing a file or writing to the file system, it locked everything else out and the phone would just hang for no apparent reason for 20 or 30 seconds while the first app finished what it was doing. It seems like they've realized the error of their ways with that stuff. And TouchWiz has actually gotten better. The version of TouchWiz that's on the Infuse was acceptable.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's coming in August if you're looking for new phones. And typically, I would expect those to launch on GSM networks first. The phones that are out now in Europe are GSM phones. So T-Mobile and AT&T probably coming to Sprint. And
I mean, from all reports in the European reviews, it's a very, very good phone. But the question is, depending on where you are in your contract, is it better to get this phone now or to wait until around Thanksgiving time when Honeycomb or not, ice cream sandwich phones are coming out?
So have either of you seen the unlocked iPhones?
You mean the ones that they sell in like
Saudi
Arabia,
like the 650?
And
no, they sell them in stores now. Unlocked,
oh, really?
$650.
And do they have a SIM card slot?
I would assume yeah,
because they totally have to be unlocked, right?
Yeah.
Because you could pick your
carrier. Yeah.
So I mean, the whole idea
they're going to be GSM phones, not CDMA phones, right?
Right. Yeah. I assume so. And I mean, perfect for travel. You know, they're for business travelers and stuff like that. I was just kind of curious if they actually had a physical SIM slot, which is something I haven't seen
Well, the iPhone 4 has a physical SIM slot too. It has a micro SIM.
Right. Can you get to it, though?
It's very easy.
Poke a hole in the side. You poke a paperclip in the hole.
Oh, okay.
It works just like the older iPhones. Yeah.
Okay.
But the question is, I don't think they changed the hardware. So, like, even on T-Mobile, you're not going to get 3G.
So it's not a quad band. It's just a tri-band based on
the network. They use a different 3G frequency.
I've also heard mixed – I've heard conflicting reports from different users who, when they've gone traveling with their iPhone, have been able to call AT&T and get them to give them an unlock code that will let them use an Orange or some other GSM card in when they're traveling where there's GSM networks. I know like that's what Matt did when he came to the United States with his Nexus 1.
So he bought an unlocked one.
He bought an unlocked Nexus 1. Well, all the Nexus ones were unlocked, But yeah, he just went to AT&T and because that's the right band for his provider and got a SIM card with data plan and all that for a month.
Yep.
But I've also heard people who tried to do that and it didn't and they were denied.
Laugh in your face.
Yeah. So, AT&T has a very generous pay us $30 and we'll give you like 45 megabytes of international data at a ridiculous rate.
That's changed. Because when I was traveling in Europe in 2009, and I had an iPhone 3G at the time, it was hugely expensive to add anything on.
It was my understanding of the way the plan works is that you pay a fee and then you also pay a per megabyte data charge.
Right.
So it was hugely expensive. It's still hugely.
Okay.
Yeah. Sarcasm.
So that hasn't. Oh, okay.
No,
yeah.
No. It's,
hasn't
it's not
changed.
A good. Don't
hasn't
do that.
Changed.
It's not a good.
Yeah.
Not a good plan. Much better to go and get a SIM card for whatever provider you're at and wherever you're going. Windows cameras. Lloyd, you're a photographer.
Yes. And, it didn't affect me that much. What we're talking about, by the way, is Microsoft said we're really seeing a set of codecs for Windows that will allow you to view RAW files directly, camera RAW files, from whatever camera, Nikons, I think, Olympus, Canons. Now, interestingly enough, the D7000 wasn't on the list, which is the camera I shoot with, and yet my D7000 F-file seemed to work.
But
I have to qualify that a little bit because I had a third-party codec pack installed, and I uninstalled it. But for all I know, that's still doing something in the background.
Mm. Well, in codec packs, I mean, I assume this works like video codec packs as well,
right.
Where once you install it, it's impossible to get them out of the system pretty much.
And that may be the case.
So you're talking about in Windows Explorer. So as opposed to having open Photoshop,
thumbnails
you can actually just click it.
Right.
How long does it take to process that RAW file for the thumbnail display?
Not any longer than a JPEG.
Oh, really? So it just pops up.
Right.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So explain something to me that I don't understand why there's different RAW formats for different cameras.
With a RAW file, you're literally looking at the specific sensor data, right? You're looking at individual data points in terms of electrical signals coming off the sensor rendered in digital format.
So the signal that comes off when the photon hits the sensor.
Right. So every time you change the sensor size, your format has to change, right? Because you're extending things out. And now there are ways around that theoretically. I mean, Adobe has a universal RAW format that I know of has adopted. but nobody's taken up on that. And everybody says, and every time a new camera comes out from Canon or Nikon, they have a new RAW format, even if the sensor hasn't. I remember when the D90 came out, right? It used the same sensor as the D300, and yet you had to wait for a new camera RAW update before you could read the RAW files in the D90.
And so this is why Photoshop, if you have Photoshop installed, you get those RAW camera, those RAW support updates every few weeks, it seems
Right. And during that period of time, you have to go back and, of course, the camera companies release their proprietary editing tools right away, right?
Mm-hmm.
When they ship the camera. So I've never quite understood that myself, especially when you're using the same sensor. I mean, I can understand it a little bit if the sensor changes,
Right.
But when they're using the same sensor and you're still having RAW file problems when you change cameras,
Is there an advantage you find of using maybe not Windows Live Photo Viewer, but just the Windows default Photo Viewer just to quickly look at RAW pictures as opposed to booting up?
Oh, yeah, that's very nice. You can see previews and stuff like that. And it's great to see the raw data because you say, oh, the lighting in that's crappy. I'm not even going to use that, or it's out of focus.
Right.
Especially I will go shoot action shots like indoor sports, right?
Okay.
I'll be shooting at 6 frames a second. And by the time I'm done, I'll have 500 photos, right? And to load all those up into Camera Raw and to have to go through even Adobe Bridge and have to go through that, it's a lot easier just to be able to cull through them with Explorer and just say delete, delete, delete for all the ones that are out of focus and stuff.
Hmm. So basically what this is called the camera codec pack. If you don't have this installed or you haven't installed some third party pack and you shoot RAW, then basically nothing shows up in Explorer. And now you can install this.
Yeah, you get the generic Windows icon.
Yeah.
Right.
So now you can see your previews and thumbnails.
Works in Windows 7, I believe, only and maybe Vista.
Do you use Windows Live Gallery, Photo Gallery?
No, I hate it.
Okay, yeah.
That's the Live Essentials one, but I use the default one.
Yeah, the default preview thing is fine.
I love preview.
The user interface for the Windows Live Photo Gallery is just abysmal.
I thought it was it has all the marks of the over dumbed down software that is like the crapware that's installed with Windows by default.
Right.
I'm not a fan.
There's other Windows Live stuff. I like Windows Live Writer. I use it for when I do blog posts.
Oh, okay.
But the photo editor is terrible. It's right up there with the Windows DVD writer thing that they have. What did they call that?
Movie Maker.
Yeah,
that was
terrible.
Bad. The one good thing about Windows Movie Maker is it was an easy way to get videos you captured in Fraps when it was hard Fraps still uses a weird codec. It's like an MJPEG based thing that they hacked together themselves, I think. It was always a pain to get Fraps stuff off of a Windows machine onto something else you could actually do video editing with. But then you had a WMV file, and what do you do with WMV files? So, last, we're getting toward the end of news here, guys. This is a big story. Who released the Netflix thing? Nielsen?
Netflix, Nielsen.
Nielsen. So Nielsen released stats on Netflix and Hulu Plus viewer, like where people are watching Netflix and Hulu Plus.
You said Nielsen's doing this, so Netflix didn't release the data?
I didn't write that down on my show notes list. So.
I would be interested to find that, because if Nielsen is collecting the data on their own, how accurate is it as opposed to say getting it actually from Netflix?
I would think they probably had to get it from Netflix.
Okay.
And it may have even not been Nielsen. I think Norm's fact checking, which we all know kills podcasts, but
maybe.
Are you saying that podcasts are only about idle speculation?
The best podcasts are about idle speculation. We should just change the name of the podcast to Idle Speculation.
It's from Nielsen.
It is from Nielsen. Okay. So I was afraid I'd gotten confused with the smartphone market share thing, which was also a Nielsen survey. They're in charge of counting people, it turns out. That's what they do. 25%.
I was a Nielsen household once, by the way.
Really?
In the old days. I mean, when I had the little box. Yeah, the little box on top of my
TV. Are you allowed to talk about that?
Well, this was like over a decade ago. Okay. So I assume any statute of limitations is expired.
Wait, are you not allowed to talk about that?
Yes, that's correct. You weren't allowed to tell people that you're a Nielsen household.
Right.
I was offered to be a Nielsen household. They sent me a dollar.
Right.
In the mail. Like, here's a dollar bill for your time.
The application process is kind of like –
there was no application. They just sort of contacted me and said, do you want to do this? I said, okay.
Oh, that's interesting.
I think they probably got my name through the cable company or something.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, so yeah, I lived with this box for a couple of years and collected data. And I would deliberately watch some shows. Let me rephrase that. I'd deliberately turn on some shows and walk away just so they would get credit.
So did that make you think – because like for a while, TiVo had a deal and my direct – like they took all the direct TiVo people that were willing to opt in.
Uh-huh.
Which the DirecTiVo was the DirecTV
thing.
Yeah. And they aggregated all that information and we were one of those families. So I was really self-conscious about what we were watching.
Right.
Like I was sitting there thinking, I don't know if I want to contribute to this.
It's like quantum mechanics, right?
Yeah.
You know, the momentum of something or the position of something, but not both. So it's like as soon as you're being observed, you start changing your behavior.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
But how much do you really extrapolate? Like you watching a show that you would normally watch, how does that affect?
It probably all randomizes out because everybody else is doing the same thing, but for their shows, right? So anyway.
Yeah.
Some stat professors having a field day.
Yeah. I just ended up leaving it on PBS.
If you found like a Craigslist forum or some type of like Nielsen's Box Insider forum and you colluded with
Nielsen hacks,
like a dozen people in your area to boost the ratings of one show, could you actually make a dent?
Well, every vote counts. They made a big deal of being like, your opinion really matters. You know, right. We got little pamphlets that said.
Yeah, you have no idea how many boxes are out there either.
Right.
Area.
Right. But we didn't have the actual box. It was just all integrated in the software and the TiVo. Did it just sit between the cable box?
Mm-hmm.
Or was
That's
it,
right. Yeah.
Okay. So it was hooked up to the cable box somehow, so it knew what channel you were on?
It was actually hooked up. Well, yes. It was hooked up to the cable box and it actually hooked up to the phone line and would like – remember, this is the old days, right?
Yeah,
and like at 4 a.m. or something, it would dial up Nielsen and send all its data.
Wow.
Every day.
So that's what the serial port on the back of the cable box is for.
I guess.
That's funny. What do you think is the most popular Netflix streaming platform, Norm?
Did we
talk about this before the show?
No, we didn't.
Okay.
I think it's the PC.
Okay, you're correct.
Computers.
Computers
people
are –
people watching on computers.
42% of people who use Netflix are watching Netflix on a PC, Mac, a computer of some sort. It doesn't specify the difference between laptops and desktops.
Does it differentiate between pads and computers?
I did, yeah. Okay. So iPads and tablets were way, way, way down the list, 2-3%, something like that, along with TiVo, TV, smart TVs.
I think number two is going to surprise you.
You know, it's pretty funny because we watch – whenever we use Netflix streaming now, we basically watch it through our Blu-ray player.
Yeah, I think that's what the TV manufacturers and the CE people were hoping was going to happen, and it hasn't taken off for most people.
So internet connected Blu-ray player is actually like sixth on the list at 11%.
We originally used the Xbox.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
The only reason I switched was because
it's loud.
Loud.
Well, that's one reason, but actually power it uses the Blu-ray player, so a ton less power.
That's why I used the Apple TV until I had stuttering problems with Netflix streaming on the Apple
TV. That's fixed itself again recently for me.
I hope so. Although Apple TV, there are obviously more Xboxes than Apple
PC?
TV. No, it's not.
No, that would be an internet-connected.
No, Apple TV is the lowest.
Oh, really?
Okay.
On the list, 1%.
Oh, that's interesting. Does it have Roku on there?
Because Roku is 5%.
Roku was the way that you know, that was the initial Netflix connected box, right?
But second to directly on the PC.
Nintendo Wii. All 480p's.
Yeah, people put the disc in and...
Well, there's no disc anymore.
Oh, okay.
You can download a channel now.
I've not used Netflix on the Wii for a while.
Right. That exclusivity arrangement went away for a while.
No, high def.
Yeah, I mean...
They're fine with composite.
Well, I think the point of this is... Or component, you mean?
The composite. Most people on Wii use composite.
Oh, right. Because you don't have a...
You have to buy the component
cables. Yeah. Oh, boy. Wow, that's grim. I mean, the compression isn't great on Netflix stuff, but
there's definitely a difference. I mean, whenever I have a bandwidth problem, or whenever I just watch a show that's in standard def, you can see how soft it looks, and versus high def, at least it looks much crisper.
It looks almost like a laser disc.
The bitrate isn't that high, but it makes a difference.
Right.
So the interesting thing to me was that and this is probably mostly a factor of Wii's market share, because I mean, they've sold a ton of Wii's over the last 5 years. And I mean, I think a lot of people have these in their entertainment centers, whether they use them or not. But the interesting thing was the PS3 and the Xbox have the same percentage as the Wii for Netflix viewing. Other platforms of note. Oh, the other interesting thing was the Hulu Plus numbers. What do you think the percentage of people who use something that's not a PC to watch Hulu Plus is? So there's a handful of devices, you know, TiVo, Xbox. Roku, I'm forgetting some other stuff.
Well, those have all been really late to the party, though, right?
Well,
plus it did pay.
Just in general,
Hulu
yeah.
Plus.
But of the people who are using Hulu Plus,
okay,
how many are using the PC versus everything else?
I can't answer this because I know the answer.
Lloyd's been watching the show notes too. It's 89% are using Hulu Plus on the PC.
Yeah, but Hulu Plus or Hulu?
Hulu Plus.
Hmm. Yeah.
Wow.
So people are paying for Hulu and not even taking advantage of what you're paying for.
Yeah. Versus tablets and phones and all. I could if the iPad was really high up on this list, I could understand that.
Right.
But
I think it's just Hulu users. I don't think it's Hulu Plus.
Okay. I wrote down Hulu Plus.
I'm looking at the chart
right
now.
Fact check. Kill the podcast. That's fine.
I would rather call you out now than have a reader call you out.
I love getting those comments. Hey, Will, you're a big dumbass. Thanks. You're a pal.
I think it's Hulu users, period.
Okay.
I think if people are paying for Hulu Plus.
Keep fact checking. We're going to keep idly speculating.
Right? No. I'm telling you. It's Hulu.
Oh, okay. So
I've been looking at the chart.
Me right now.
I've been looking at it the whole time.
You could have just said, hey, you wrote it down wrong.
Which is why I asked.
Oh, my God.
He was setting a trap for you.
Coyness. Right. Akbar. Okay, so it's all Hulu. That makes more sense.
That
it's
makes
Hulu
a lot more sense. I don't think people are going to pay $5 a month just to get access to expanded database
of
shows.
Of all those PC users, I'm guessing a really tiny percentage of those actually connect those to their TV.
I would
Well, you know what? That's actually a separate category. They differentiate in the survey directly with computer and then connecting a computer to the TV.
And
or HDMI out, right?
And for connecting computer, there's overlap.
Right.
So it's 20% connect computer to TV for Hulu, which makes sense because then you don't have to pay for Hulu Plus.
Right.
You just get the out. And Netflix, it's 14%.
That's actually a pretty significant number.
Yeah. The people who don't want to buy
– and I
guess that would count for Mac minis too. People using Mac minis as their Netflix
or a netbook or something like that.
Yeah.
I mean, an old netbook makes a pretty okay watching Hulu in standard def.
I think also I'm betting that most of those PCs that they actually connect have HDMI out.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. I mean, HDMI out's easy at this point.
Right. Exactly.
The thing I kind of wonder about is I just don't understand watching TV on the computer. Like if I'm sitting in front of a computer and I have a real web browser in front of me.
You're not a college student.
There are so many better things I can do with that time.
You are not a college student. A lot of people just have laptops.
Little story, right? So my daughter, when she was
– Is a college student.
Is a college student.
Okay.
And one of the things she would do when she was visiting at home, like friends of hers would come over, right? And they all like – three or four of them like crawl into her bed, her big bed, and crowd around the PC and watch a movie. And I said, why don't you go downstairs and watch
an enormous
big
TV?
Screen?
Yeah.
And they said, no, we're okay. And it's like, oh, all right. So, yeah.
Do college kids watch TV? Did you watch TV when you were in college?
I didn't have a TV. I watched it on my computer.
See, I just didn't watch TV in college.
Yeah, so the TV you had, I don't know about you, but in my college TV, you had one TV that was kind of the communal TV.
Right.
I didn't have one in my room. I had a stereo, you know, and an actual vinyl record player, right? Because I'm old.
Wow.
But no, the TV.
Norm had a vinyl record player because he was a hipster.
Right, right. So, yeah, you know, when it goes around, comes around. Anyway, so, but the TV thing was a communal thing in like the you know,
yeah. You had a room with couches right. at the end of the floor.
And the only time we ever watched TV was Saturday Night Live.
Right.
Everybody would crowd in there and watch Saturday Night Live. That was it.
This was still funny yeah. back then.
Right.
Okay. See, so I had a TV in my room. I'm different ages. We've got like three generations of college student here.
TV in your room.
I think I had a 19-inch tube TV, and I bought a VCR.
So that's where you watched right. Melrose Place.
I didn't have reception in my room, so we couldn't watch Melrose Place in my room. It was a real problem. But you know, I had a VCR, so we would watch. I think I had Empire Strikes Back and Star Wars. No, Return of the Jedi, naturally. And that was before I realized that there was a lower point than Return of the Jedi to Star Wars movies. And I think Reservoir Dogs or something like that. So like we would all – people would hang out and watch movies, but it was – nobody – we hardly ever watched TV. I mean –
I wouldn't have wanted to put a 19-inch tube TV into a dorm room. It's just too large. It takes up too much space.
Well,
I was so proud of buying two 21-inch CRTs for my dorm room.
Wow, you had dual monitors?
I had dual 21-inch
wow.
– I think it was ViewSonic CRTs shipped to my dorm room, bought off Craigslist or eBay. Yeah.
You're an enormous nerd.
It was before I trusted LCDs for gaming.
See, I went the other way around. See, when I was getting into that, I had one – remember those 24-inch Sony CRTs?
Oh, I had
the wide ones. Yeah, John Carmack used those for programming.
900W or whatever. I had one of those.
Yeah. They were so good. When mine died – eventually mine just kept fading more and more. And when it finally died, it was a sad, sad day. I just don't get watching TV in college. I had much better things to do with my time. I don't like watching TV now, though.
The whole Netflix thing illustrates college students are watching what TV they want to watch. They don't just randomly watch TV.
Right.
So, I mean, you can't be outside all the time. There's a time when you're about to write a paper when TV is the most attractive thing ever.
Oh, as a procrastination tool, I guess TV has a strong point.
Oh, yeah.
And if it's just a browser click away, then that changes that dynamic. So. Yeah.
I told the story about how I got through a paper once by zip tying my hands to the keyboard.
Wow.
I zip tied both my hands to the keyboard cord so I could not go to bed.
Wow.
And told my roommate, don't give me the scissors until the paper is done.
You're lucky there wasn't a fire.
Very.
Well, I guess you could have just unplugged the cord.
It would have been a disaster
with you.
Either way.
Yeah. I should have done that last night when I should have been writing the Lion stuff and went to bed instead because I'm old. Volts. This is car tech. Chevy Volt, Nissan Leaf been out for a while now. Sales numbers got reported earlier this week. Total sold around 6,000 nationwide.
Not very impressive.
Well, no, you know.
I would have expected a little more.
Well, considering that the Leaf is only being sold in areas where there's a support system for pure electric cars. Yeah. I mean, that kind of makes sense. They've sold 3,800 Leafs and 2,750 Volts at this point.
I mean, Motor Trend, you know, car of the year and all that jazz, right?
Well, I saw my first Volt in the wild this morning on the way into work.
Oh, there's actually at the gym I go to work out. There's one parked there every morning.
Yeah, I saw a guy coming up the hill out of Pacifica and in the right lane just chugging along.
Yeah, I think the fact that the Volt is really a hybrid car, a plug-in hybrid sort of more than a real electric car, has had an impact, particularly since, you know, I don't recall when it was announced, but Prius announced their plug-in not long after the Volt.
Right. Well, I mean, the 2012 models will be, be a plug-in.
And
also,
so people are just waiting for that, I think.
I mean, the interesting thing to me, though, is that the Leaf is outselling. I think it's more a testament to people not trusting the Volt than the Leaf being a spectacular car.
Well, it was bad when they rolled out that, you know, the big press conference and it was like they had the, you know, 300 miles per gallon or whatever it was.
Right.
And then that was way too sensational. And then people realized, hey, there is actually a gas engine in here or a generator.
But it's not even that. It's that it's not a fantastic car.
It was a good car.
It was okay.
I totally like the look of the Volt.
But
I mean, the list price of that thing was $40,000, which was essentially a plug-in hybrid.
Yeah. Right? So. I mean, and when you're comparing – when the Prius is going to come out, it'll be 32 loaded as a plug-in option probably.
Right.
Then it's a
really surprised sell. There was no Volt in a new Transformers movie.
Well –
because it's a GM Chevy deal.
Yeah.
I mean
– that is interesting.
Camaro.
Product placement.
But no Volt.
They had a lot of SUVs though. A lot of big SUVs.
Just saying, it would have been a good opportunity.
They probably would have had to make the Volt super racist like they did in the last one.
It could have been hippie. Could have totally been a hippie car.
Transformer?
Yeah.
Nobody wants a nonviolent Transformer, Norm. That's a terrible idea.
They had one in the movie anyway.
Ugh. Laptops responsible for the majority of 3G data use, says Gigaom.
I believe it.
Have you ever tethered your laptop to your phone?
No.
Have you ever tethered your laptop to your phone?
No, not at all.
Even with Wi-Fi?
But I'm not a business person.
Well, you're wearing a tie. Are you wearing khakis?
Nope.
No khakis.
But yeah. No, I believe that. Yeah. People, Android free tethering, basically.
Well, not so much anymore.
Right. But you can still hack your way into it. And people with, I believe it. Because when you're on your laptop, the number of people tethering might not be a lot.
Well,
the data
per user is going to be a lot higher.
Exactly.
I'm not sure it's all tethering. I think a lot of the business laptops that I see come with 3G built in.
Well, that's true too. Yeah,
it's a big market. And you are also talking about like the MiFis.
Mm-hmm.
That's all 3G.
That counts as well, I suppose. Yeah. I realized we forgot to talk about the Fox thing on Hulu this week. So Fox announced that there's going to be an 8-day exclusivity window for its original content.
Are we really surprised?
I mean,
all News Corp.
What, you think this is a result of phone tapping?
No, I think they have pushed paywall.
It is a Murdoch thing.
Yeah, Murdoch is pushing for paywalls on everything.
Oh, okay. So this is part of the...
Yeah, this is part of Murdoch's crusade for you must pay for content.
The end of free content on the interwebs. Yeah. Okay, well, in that context, it makes a lot more sense.
But, I mean, at least it's just an 8-day wait. I mean, a lot of people, when they go on Hulu anyway, they watch... shows.
It's
like
whatever's there.
It's whatever's there. They watch seasons at a time, old shows. I don't know a lot of people who do the Hulu thing like the day after.
Is this going to apply to Hulu? Well, that's why my wife has a Hulu Plus subscription. Is if she misses something, then she can go back and catch it the day later. If the TiVo fails.
Three levels of fail safe for TV.
Well, it's important.
anything but piracy.
There's some crazy stuff. Yeah. I mean, so there's this one Canadian show we watched called Flashpoint, right?
Okay.
Ignoring how good the show or not, whether people care about it. So season 3, you can't watch the entire season, which is over. Season 3 is past, right? You can't watch the entire season on Netflix. So I think he says, you must get the rest of them on disc. So I say, cool, I'll just order them from Netflix. It's annoying, but you can do it. Turns out you can't.
Oh, so they don't have the discs?
In fact, no. See, if you buy season 3 off Amazon, you still don't get all of season 3.
Oh, so it's like the Battlestar Galactica season 3.5 thing.
Right, right.
Oh,
I think part of what was going on is they're cutting deals with different networks and they're changing networks and all that sort of confusion happened. And so now I think the only way you can get those episodes if you care to is like watching it directly off the CBS website or something like that.
Wow.
Oh, wow. So does the Fox thing apply to Hulu Plus as well?
I don't know.
That's the big question, right?
It probably shouldn't.
Because you're already paying for it.
I would hope it shouldn't, but you know,
yeah.
Maybe there's two layers of paywall.
No.
You have a paywall for your paywall? Seems like a bad idea.
I'm going to stop you right there.
I found the whole Battlestar Galactica, like the way they did the Battlestar Galactica disc where they do half the season.
Right.
They produced it that way though.
I don't care.
Well.
They should have just
buy the entire box set.
Call it an extra season.
buy the entire box set.
Seems like nickel and diming you to death on stuff that you shouldn't have to do. Facebook iPad app
hidden in the Facebook iPhone app.
Yeah.
Why do people care about this?
I don't know.
People care about it because people have been waiting for people. Facebook is still like
people still use Facebook.
One of the biggest sites on the internet.
Well, no. I understand that Facebook is popular and people care about using it. But the fact that this app existed for a brief period of time and will eventually exist for real, I assume.
I would hope.
I mean, why do people make a big deal? Why do
people want to see what the interface is like?
Okay.
They want to see how – because Facebook made a big deal of having a really good web app before Apple said, hey, we're okay with actual App Store. But they're also very late to the game with a tablet.
Here's the thing for me on the Facebook app. I'm fine with – and we had a question about this that we're not going to run either because it was kind of a weird-sounding question. Reader asked how we feel about HTML5. I think HTML5 is really good. I like especially on content sites, I love having an HTML5 mobile site where you can play video and all that stuff. And there's no flash and it just kind of works. The one place that HTML5 breaks down now is the notifications. And because of the way I use Facebook – somebody who doesn't go to Facebook unless I get a notification that says, hey, somebody sent you a message or something. There's something here that requires a response.
Right.
I'm never going to go to Facebook if there's no notification for me. So that's why an iPad app is is exciting for a lot
Gmail
of users.
Gmail blocked all my Facebook notifications. I didn't know I was getting Facebook notifications.
That's
not getting
fantastic. I'd pay for that feature.
It's considered spam now, and I thought no one does anything for Facebook. And then I log into Facebook. Hey, I got messages.
Well, the notifications thing, like the notifications now – okay, this is a very specific problem to people that have a lot of people following them on the internet.
Oh, okay. Here's a Will Smith problem.
No. It applies to you guys too. People who are public. It's the way Google Plus handles notifications is nightmarish. Because my favorite thing about Twitter is that on the phone clients, I can set it to only give notifications from people who I'm following. So when you send me an at reply, I get the phone bings. When Norm sends me an at reply, the phone rings. The other 85 people a day that send me at replies, I scroll through when I check. But if the phone binged every time I got an at reply from anybody on the internet, I'd have to turn it off.
Right.
It renders it unusable. Google Plus doesn't have that kind of filtering now. So the only way – I had to turn off all the Google Plus notifications.
Because you couldn't
– last night at 11 o'clock filter. At night, the phone was on my nightstand going because Gary posted something that mentioned me. That notification control stuff, Twitter does it really well. Facebook even is pretty good at it.
I mean, Google Plus is still in beta, right? I mean, they're going to fix a lot of that stuff over time.
Is Gmail still in beta? Like, they finally
– I know, but Google Plus really is in beta.
It's a real beta. Right. It's a beta. Yeah. I think they're going to fix that, but that is – It called into sharp relief how important notification
I find is. What's interesting is the whole controversy over pseudonyms versus real names and the fact that some large people are getting shut out because
of all the way back to like the Quake days, like playing games. Like some people's preferences use the handles, online personas, and then some people just use real names.
There's a time and a place for real names and there's a time and a place for handles.
Right. And especially when you are known by your online persona as opposed to nobody knows who John Jones might be, but they might know the online persona because that's what he goes by. And I think that's an interesting problem.
They banned people is why we're talking about this. In the last 2 weeks, Google has gone through and killed or disabled.
Dr. Kiki. They booted Dr. Kiki.
I don't know who Dr. Kiki is.
She does a podcast on science. She's one of Leah Laporte Network.
Okay.
And she's very popular. And they booted her because she called herself Dr. Kiki instead of Kiki Sanders or whatever her real name is.
Oh, wow.
That's not even a big stretch.
Right.
Right. I mean, is she a doctor?
She's a PhD.
That's a doctor in my book. They also kicked off a bunch of brands, which I'm actually okay with. I think the reasoning behind that – yeah, there was Mashable, Boing Boing, a whole bunch of other people had built pages for their brands. We didn't do that because, frankly, I couldn't be bothered. But they killed all those because the rule is right now if you're connected to Google Plus, you need to attach a human being's real name to it. And it seems like they're also booting people who have unusual but real names too. So
is really unfortunate.
Well, it's kind of funny because they're making people send in pictures of their driver's license and stuff like that. And the funniest part of that is the instructions that they send to those people say blur out any personally identifying information.
Except your name.
Except for your name. Yeah.
Sucks for Shannon Sossman's son, whose name is like Audio Visual or Audio Video Club or something.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. They've been doing that. They're really being I don't want to say fascist, but they're taking a pretty heavy hand to that. I'm okay with that.
Real names. They're not trying to do the whole we're gonna be an outlet for commercial activity like Facebook is.
Well, no, they're doing is saying we're going to have a well established and thought out plan for that, and until then, please don't try. I think the thing is there's going to be another one of those Facebook short name Facebook gold rushes. When Google Plus allows brands to build pages as well, I'm sure they'll roll it out with selected brands first.
Right.
So, I really like the way Google Plus does. I wish that there was the one thing that I wish that they had that they don't is a way to have kind of community generated circles that you could join. The Sparks are kind of like that, but not really.
Right.
Just so that I could say, hey, here's a tested page. If you guys want to see what we're doing, sign up for that. And they don't have that at this point. So. That's coming. I mean, they've said it's coming. I don't know what the timeline is on that. So we talked about the Facebook. Logitech CEO quit and the Google TV, the Logitech Google TV.
Logitech price, review.
The review.
R-E-V-U-E.
Dropped to $99 from an original price of, I think, $300. I don't think it was $399.
I was surprised that it was $300.
Well, $300 was crazy. And then they immediately dropped that to $200 when the reviews were terrible. And now
250.
Well, Logitech is a huge, pretty large company that sells a lot of stuff. So what's got to do with the CEO resigning?
The announcements happened at the same time.
Okay.
I know that they invested a ton in Google TV. They had a bad – they lost money for the first time in a fairly significant period of time. And the CEO stepped down as a result of that.
Well, I do know that. I tend to follow Logitech products because I'm a PC nerd, right?
Yeah.
Keyboards and all that jazz. And they haven't done a lot of new stuff recently either.
They haven't done any big stuff. They do a lot of they're doing a lot of phone and tablet accessories and stuff like that I kind of don't care about.
That's right.
They switched a lot of the keyboards. Now they're offering chiclet and traditional keyboard designs. Right. But I mean, it's not they haven't been exciting products in a while.
Right.
And even the stuff that I am excited about, like the Harmony. I don't know if you're a Harmony remote user.
I think saved my marriage.
Yeah, those things are fantastic. Mm-hmm. I can have 10 things hooked up to my TV, and I don't get yelled at from my wife when she's trying to figure out how to get.
But the best one's still the one that was released 2 years ago.
The Harmony One.
Yes, I have one of those.
Yeah, yeah. I'm even using an older. I'm using like a 900 or 895 or something.
The only thing they've done is update it with those RF instead of the RF stuff.
Well, but you could get those on the old ones.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. Yeah. I think they're having – and then they purchased Squeezebox a few years ago, and I think they tried to make that a low-end product and had not a lot of success with that.
Right. And the problem I've had with Squeezebox was it didn't involve with the industry. So you still have this product that now requires its own server and all that kind of stuff, and who wants that anymore?
Right. Well, I have a home server. I'm okay with running a server, but the Sonos approach is just to hook it up to a network share, or even better, just connect it to RDO or Spotify or whatever your music service is, and don't worry about it.
Squeezebox is one of the first devices to have Pandora support before Pandora apps.
Oh yeah, I mean, I had a Squeezebox. I had multiple Squeezeboxes in my house for a long time, and have replaced them with AirPort Express.
So what are the big keyboard TV manufacturers, like peripheral manufacturers? There aren't many.
Logitech and Keytronics
Microsoft still sells a lot of keyboards.
Right.
Not mice anymore, especially in the gaming.
Well, they don't sell any gaming mice or gaming keyboards. They still sell all the mice.
Yeah, if you go to a brick and mortar store, tons of Microsoft keyboards and mice.
Right. Well, and it's all the Ergo 4000, natural Ergo 4000 and Comfort Curve and all that. So
even though more people are buying notebooks, people in offices still use keyboards.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are still connecting their laptop PCs to docking stations or to monitors and keyboards and mice.
I'd like to see some innovations in keyboard design.
I literally don't understand why there's no touchpad equivalent. I mean, I know there are, but they're mostly low quality, kind of pack rim, inexpensive, and not very good touchpads. But why are there no keyboards with a thumb rest with the touchpad built in the same position it is on a laptop? I mean, that is a really easy way to move the mouse cursor.
There's a couple of really expensive ones, but
The ones on the touchpad on the side, and Asus has a couple of those.
But the benefit of having the touchpad under the keyboard is you just flip your thumb back and it's there.
If you go down to Central Computer,
I've seen.
They have $100 keyboard, right? And it's an ergonomic keyboard, split, all that jazz, and it's got a touchpad on it.
Oh, I'm going to have to go buy that. I'm going to go try it out.
Is it mechanical?
What do you mean? It's not mechanical. It's not an Alps tile, if that's what you're talking about. Mechanical,
like the keys.
It's a membrane.
I think it's still a membrane keyboard, but it's a full key thing. It looks like somebody added a touchpad to a Microsoft 4000.
Perfect. That's exactly what I want. I want is a magic trackpad wedged into the Microsoft 4000.
Okay.
All I need is Microsoft and Apple.
I don't know how well it works, so don't.
Well, we'll test it out. We will test it out.
Okay.
I'll spend the $100 to find out. And a couple other quick hits. AT&T is finally – the 2011 Android phones from AT&T are finally getting Gingerbread. The Atrix got it earlier this week. Infuse is supposedly coming soon, air quotes. And then that other – I can't remember what the low-end Android phone that came out on AT&T earlier this year. It wasn't one of the super phones. It was kind of a – it was a last gen in current gen hardware and current gen pricing. And finally, the Google Toolbar. Do you guys use toolbars?
Nope. God, no.
Does anybody use toolbars?
Not knowingly.
Not my mom. My mom has a lot of toolbars installed.
You install Skype and if you install
She has Yahoo, and Google.
Oh.
Google's killing the toolbar for Firefox after version 4. So Firefox 5, there will be no Google toolbar for. If you need a instant button for Google toolbar or for Google Reader and PageRank checking, you either need to stay on Firefox 4 or just put a link in your hotlink.
Toolbar, it was always it was very memory intensive, and there were a lot of it looked like an ad. like these features are being built into the browser, like,
right.
with RockMelt. Like basically, RockMelt.
You mean RockMeIt?
RockMelt. We had this conversation before.
Damn it.
RockMelt has those features built into the actual navigation plane.
Yeah. Oh, well, yeah, of course. Well, and you can add extensions to get the same functionality for the most part, or at least the stuff that you'd want. I remember installing toolbars to block pop-ups and stuff like that back in the bad old days before the browsers did all that. But I don't think there's any need for it anymore. I think Google also wants to push people over to Chrome rather than supporting Firefox. So that is it for news this week. Did we forget anything? I'm going to play the music then, and we'll talk about what we've been testing. We've already talked about Lion a little bit. Norm, you purchased MacBook Air earlier this week, I guess.
Oh, I purchased it the morning it came out.
You've stickered it. It has a Gamago sticker
yeah.
now.
It's mine. Forever.
You've marked it as
forever's
yours.
Are you? I'm making Lloyd very irritated right now with this lust over the MacBook.
I don't want a MacBook.
You don't want a MacBook Air?
No, exactly. Lloyd's a PC user.
Yeah. Oh.
So, okay.
So
we had this conversation before the podcast started. I'm looking at one of the Sonys.
I know.
We're
setting up drama here.
Okay. The backstory for Lloyd, in case you know, Gary got one of these right. in October.
Okay.
And it was the hardware refresh.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the new 11-inch and still Core 2 Duo. He brought it over for our Star Trek marathon. We did a TNG marathon last year. And he had it on the couch, and I was using an iPad, and I was like, wow, it looks just as pretty much the same size, but he could do so much more. He could have like tab browsing, like real computing.
Right. It's a real computer.
Mm-hmm.
And I got incredibly jealous, and I said, I'm getting whenever they upgrade the guts to it, I'm considering getting one.
Yeah, because the first spin was Core 2 Duos kind of.
Core 2 Duos. And,
right.
and since this one came out last Wednesday, I believe.
It doesn't matter.
Announced last Wednesday, it came out last Thursday. Performance is amazing. It's Sandy Bridge on the inside. You're
right.
still paying a little bit of a premium. I think this came out to about $1,350 after taxes. But the idea
that's actually in the same price class as both the Sony and that Samsung thing.
Yeah,
is, right?
Yeah.
Think about it. I got the processor upgrade. So the processor actually on the Intel's Arc site, it's about like $315, the 1.8 gigahertz.
Right.
So, you know, it's. I think it's a fair price.
Well, and more than the clock speed on this, since it's moving from an i5 to i7, you're paying for bigger cache and hyper-threading, right?
Yeah. You get 4 megabytes of cache. It's on a – I think you get hyper-threading, still 2 cores, and it's on a 1333 megahertz.
I'm always a little uncertain about mobile processors because it's
– they have lot
the
of
same
SKUs,
names.
A lot of SKUs.
But things are different.
But for me, it's a big upgrade because previously my work computer was a 4-year-old MacBook Pro pre-unibody. So this is – first,
and it was a Core 2 Duo as well,
and it's
right?
Core 2 Duo. Yeah.
Right.
So this is the first chiclet keyboard I've had, first glass touchpad with no buttons, which I'm still trying to get a little used to, and the first like unibody design and line. So it's a big jump for
well,
me.
And it's 2 pounds and change.
Yeah. I don't think I'm going to do a review because I'm too close to it, and I bought
That's
it.
Probably a good policy.
But I will write up my experience with it. Already, it's changed the way I compute in the office because I can take this to meetings, and even when we're shooting videos, I can.
You're sitting on the couch behind me all the time.
Yes, as opposed to my shoes are off half the day now.
Yeah, it's pretty gross.
Yeah, and my back is hurting from the slouching.
So one of the things when we did the quick look at this earlier this week, a lot of the comments were. Man, you're not getting any computer for that amount of money. Why are you paying so much? That's stupid. I could build a PC that's $600 and just as – and the point that people miss is when you buy a computer that's sub 3 pounds, you know, you're looking for a minimum level of performance to do the workloads you
right.
need. But you want something that can slide into a bag and carry and not know it's there.
And in fact, you know, Windows PCs that are that thin and that light, which there's a few, tend to cost that much too, maybe – so you're not, you know, you're not paying a price premium in this case for the Mac as you would in a more normal laptop.
Right. Well, and there's a little price premium.
Right. But it's not, you know, it's interesting to me though. I looked at the pricing a lot, and the price premium, like on a 15-inch MacBook versus a relatively equivalent. I'm not talking about a cheapo Windows laptop, but a relatively equivalent is like 30%.
Yeah.
And on this, it's like more like 10 to 15%.
Yeah. So, it's an interesting one of the things that I'm finding as the lower end performs better.
Right.
You know, we've reached a point with personal computing where I feel like the only way you can get a bad performance experience if you're a email web browsing, watching video,
right.
typical, you know, 90% of people out there that are buying computers for home use, computer user, is if you go out and buy something that's running Atom.
Right.
You know.
Yeah. In fact, I had an interesting experience when I went on my vacation recently. I took one of these I can't remember. It's a Toshiba laptop, but it's got one of those Athlon X2 Neos, which is like a 1.5 gigahertz, you know, netbook class, maybe just a tiny bit better than a netbook.
Right.
And I was running Photoshop on it, right? And it was fine.
So, but the AMD ones aren't, they're using a current generation processor, not a fixed, an older.
Right. But my point is, it's still, I mean, 1.5 gigahertz, still fairly slow on the processor performance curve. We're talking about a laptop that I think lists for $400.
Right.
And for doing Photoshop stuff, even some filters and stuff, it wasn't bad.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing that we found with the kind of preliminary benchmarks we ran on the Airs. That Air is actually faster at the mix. You know, one of the only things that I do on a regular basis that requires a lot of CPU power is the mix down on the podcast.
Right.
It's 2 hours. There's 3, 4, 5 audio tracks. It takes a long time, even on a big machine. And I mean, the thing that we use in the podcast room is a dual core, Core 2 Duo iMac that's 3 years old. Mm-hmm. It takes 40 minutes. It takes 27 minutes on a 2 hour podcast, 27:30, something like that. On my laptop, which is more or less the same processor as in this iMac, it's a Core 2 Duo, 2.5 gigahertz. It takes 27 minutes. On Norm's iMac, it took 17 minutes.
MacBook Air.
And MacBook Air. Did I say netbook?
Yeah, you said iMac.
iMac. Norm's MacBook Air, it's 17 minutes. They're both running SSDs. They're different SSDs, so there's a potential difference there. But I mean, it's amazing. Mm-hmm. The even though the clock speeds are significantly lower on the Core i5s, it's a big change whether you're running the Windows or Mac or whatever on the OS front. So you're looking at a thin and light as well, right?
Yeah.
Right, Lloyd?
I was looking at one of the Sonys potentially. But my gating factor is that I have to have a high-res display because I do photo editing on the fly. So at minimum, I want a 16:9, and I'd ideally like a 1080p display.
Yeah.
So when you think thin and light, 13-inch?
Probably, maybe. The Sony makes a 13-inch, I think, 16:9.
You wouldn't want to wait for like the Ultrabooks to come out? That's supposed to be.
What
are Ultrabooks, Norm?
Intel's MacBook Air competitors.
I want to see performance in those first.
So basically, Intel is taking the same processors that they're selling.
It's
going to
be Sandy Bridge i5s.
And they're selling them to Asus and Acer, and they're trying to create this new category of, they call them Ultrabooks, that are basically MacBook Air competitors.
Well, this is what Apple does that's really magic. Steve Jobs calls Apple magical all the time, but the thing that they've done that is magical is they've taken what was a $2,500 laptop 4 years ago and made it a $1,000 laptop this year.
Right.
Because, you know, whether you're talking about the Lenovo S200, which is not really even in the same kind of weight and thickness class, it's a much bigger laptop, or the old Toshiba S500s, they were woefully underpowered, usually I think Yona, right? I mean, they were essentially overclocked Pentium 3s, single core, very slow machines.
Right.
And they were executive laptops was what the category was frequently called. And they started at $1,700, $1,800 and went up all the way to $2,000 or $3,000. And of course, part of the price change is just price pressure coming down. But part of it is that Apple has leveraged their supply chain to make something that I would have said was impossible 3 or 4 years ago.
Right. Well, if I can get over my own personal sort of hump, which is I have to let go of the security blanket that is the optical drive, right?
Yeah.
And it's my problem. I recognize that. I hardly ever use an optical drive anymore on a laptop.
Yeah.
And if I can like kind of get past that hump, I can probably get just about anything I want.
Don't you have Windows on a thumb drive at this point?
Well, what's wrong with a USB optical drive?
Well, it's one of those personal quirks that I just have to get past, right?
You know, I mean, for me, it's the Ethernet port. Like, that was the biggest thing.
Yeah, no Ethernet port is weird.
No Ethernet port for me. I don't trust Wi-Fi as reliable as, you know, most of the time it is, but no Ethernet port on a laptop.
On
my primary computer.
Yeah.
When I'm, you know, transfer.
That would be a big deal for me too, because I have a gigabit network at home and moving stuff around is like a really.
So, you know, you can get a USB Ethernet adapter and you get those in the gigabit range too.
Well, I wonder how long before the Thunderbolt Ethernet adapters come out. I mean,
those cables are expensive.
Those cables are expensive.
So, I don't know. You can get a USB one for like $16 on Amazon.
Right, but then you're going to be gated by. Well, it probably USB end up hub. Being okay. Yeah, yeah. I'm just the whole. It's funny the values how I value changes, and like I said, as the computers become more capable, the performance becomes less of an issue.
So the one
overall,
the one thing people have complained about this the MacBook Air is the battery, the new one. Apple rates it at 5 for the 11 inch. I've never seen. The first thing I did was turn on the battery icons to tell you what time.
Right.
And it's funny to watch that fluctuate. It goes up and down based on how you're using the computer.
Yeah.
I've never seen it higher than 4, even at a full charge. On its estimate.
Is that, and that's with your brightness all the way down and all that?
Brightness in the middle.
Okay.
50% brightness on battery. So I doubt that I can probably get 5 hours of normal use battery life with this. But 5 hours, I mean, compared to 2 years ago, 3 years ago on a.
Oh, yeah, that's pretty good.
Yeah, it's very good.
Yeah. Well, 5 hours is something that you can use for a work day.
Yeah.
That's my experience. Well,
working around.
If you assume that you're going to sit down at your desk at some point and plug in, then it lasts all day long.
That's a curious question for readers. Do people turn on, like, the time left on their battery or the percentage?
I always have time left.
On the phone, I have the percentage because I'm OCD
about
that.
There's no time left on the phone.
That would be funny if there was.
That's bad.
You'd be
bad
completely
idea.
Obsessive. Oh, you have 30 minutes left on the phone based on standard use.
This is why I can't buy a Leaf, right? If I had, literally, if I had 60 miles, if I knew I had 60 or 75 miles or whatever it is.
But they have those on gas cars too.
No, I know, but I know that there's gas stations everywhere.
Right.
I would have to know where every Nissan dealership is because that's like the most common place to plug those in. And I would be crippled constantly thinking, oh, well, I'd like to go to the grocery store tonight, but I can't afford to stop.
One of the interesting things, startups that have come around, I can't remember the name of the company now, but I was reading about this, and what they're trying to develop is a standard battery pack.
Oh, yeah, I read about this.
That you can just pull in a station and you swap battery packs and you go on your way again.
So let me ask you, do you have a gas grill?
Yeah, no, I have a charcoal grill.
You have a charcoal grill. So I have a gas grill. Well, I have gas charcoal, but different conversation. I don't like the tank swaps. Because I look at those and the tank swaps look really nice on the outside. They freshly paint them every few times and, there's no big rust spots. But I think about what those tanks are looking like on the inside after they've been cycled through a couple hundred times and how the guy who's inspecting the inside with the fiber optic light occasionally to make sure that they're clear. I just take I go buy a new tank every few years.
You're visualizing Will Smith being engulfed in a fireball.
Yeah, I don't want to be out making some hamburgers one day and explode.
You don't like propane accessories?
I like propane accessories, but I use my tanks and I take them to the gas station down the street that has a propane filler. And even though that's also kind of a terrifying experience when the guy's out there with the screwdriver and the big jet of gas comes out and you're like, man, it smells like exploding. And I don't think I want to swap batteries. I think that makes me like if I'm going to be obsessive compulsive about taking good care of my batteries, I don't want the guy who doesn't have the same level of obsession, even though it probably doesn't matter at all.
It probably if they build the electronics that hybrid cars build into batteries,
right?
It probably won't matter at all.
No, I am completely aware of that, but like you and the optical drives,
right?
I don't miss that. When I swapped the SSD into the MacBook, I thought about getting one of those kits to pop the optical drive out and put the put a traditional hard drive in that slot,
right?
Just so you'd have more storage.
Mm-hmm.
And I left the optical drive, and I've not used it since. So I don't miss that at all. The only time I use the optical drive on the PC at this point in the age of Steam is to rip Blu-ray discs.
Well, you see, every now and then I think I don't need an optical drive, right? So then, like, I'll do something like I'll go to a Microsoft PR event and they hand out CDs with all the stuff on it. Right? It's like, this is Microsoft. You guys should be handing out
thumb
flash
drives.
Right?
Yeah, they always give flat thumb drives. You're going to better PR events than I am. So what else have we been testing? We talked about Lion a little bit already. It's kind of up and down, I think.
I have to talk about these toys that I brought along.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Well, let's save do you want to save that for a?
We should talk about the boxes here, and then save the other thing for fake outtakes because it's a perfect fake outtakes conversation.
Oh, I have one more thing. I
got to talk about Sonos too.
Okay, talk about Sonos, and then I can.
Okay, so we got. Are you familiar with Sonos?
Yes,
Lloyd?
I've used their stuff before. Pretty neat stuff.
It's really neat. It's kind of expensive, but they're pushing toward a high end market who is going to be less price conscious than probably I am. The S3 is their new speaker system. We talked about it a little bit last week, but it's basically a three-speaker version of the Play 5. I'm sorry, it's the Play 3 and the Play 5. They've renamed it. Used to be the S5. This is a three-speaker version, kind of competing in the same space as iPod docks, iPhone docks.
Okay. And you say three-speaker, does that mean subwoofer?
They use a kind of weird back-blasting sub.
Okay.
I don't think I would call it a sub, but okay. I mean it produces –
It's the base unit.
Yeah, it's the base. The base is directed out of the back of the box, and it sounds pretty good.
Okay.
It's not as good as the S5. It's definitely not as good as a dedicated loudspeaker system. But you know, for the $300 that you pay or $200, I think it's $300, right? Norm, do you remember?
$300.
$300
for this Play 3.
It's it sounds good. Right. Better than most of the iPod docks that are in that same price range that I've tested the years.
It sounds very good. I'm a little suspicious because they're not a speaker manufacturer.
Right.
And they don't list too many detailed specs about the drivers.
I'm – you know, that's one of those things that I feel like a lot of the specs about the drivers are kind of meaningless.
You're paying a lot for the technology.
Yeah. It's right. Also, you know, in terms of drivers, it's all about what signal they actually deliver to the drivers.
Right.
You know, you can get clean stuff out of really crappy drivers if you do it right.
Well, and they've done traditionally – they didn't specifically talk about what kind of DAC and what kind of amplifier they're using.
I don't think they have their own.
Well, they used to use Brown Burr DACs that were really nice in the Zone players, mm-hmm. the ones that have an amplifier built in. My problem with the earlier Zone players, the ones that you put in the ceiling or in the wall or wherever and then hook in ceiling or in wall speakers too, was that they just didn't have enough power to get really loud because they were passively cooled.
Right.
But they said that the sound quality was always really nice, especially if you hook them up to decent speakers. So this works the same way as the other stuff. You know, you set up each of these speakers is a zone, can be its own zone. It can be grouped into others.
Right.
So the idea with this is that you, put multiples of these devices in your home. You can have different music in each room, or you can join them all together and have a big, giant home sound system where everything plays the same, or any combination of the two. You can have the same song playing in the kitchen, the living room, and the same song playing in the two bedrooms, or split it up any way you want.
It's their whole mesh network concept.
Yeah. Exactly.
It really is a super neat technology. I mean, it's kind of thing that we wish like – was built in.
I would love to, like, if I was building a house from scratch, I would just put these in rooms and put in wall speaker systems and call it a day. The nice thing about the Play line, the Play 5 and Play 3, is that they're portable. So, you know, they're because of the wireless mesh network that they all connect to. If I wanted to go out and have music in the back porch on Saturday, all I need to do is carry the speaker out, plug it in outside, it pops back up, and I have music out in the outside, which is pretty awesome. It's you know, my only real complaint with these products is the price. It's pretty expensive.
Do you have
for normal people.
So does that mean you have a Sonos base station somewhere?
The way the network works is you either any of the devices can be plugged into Ethernet.
Right.
You just need one.
Just one thing.
Just jumpstart the
mesh. Start the mesh.
Right.
They sell what they call the bridge, which is a
I remember those.
Yeah, standalone single device.
It's really a repeater is what it is.
Yeah, exactly. It's you plug it into your network and then it is the initial connection point for the mesh network. And they've dropped the price on that. It used to be $100 and I think now it's $50.
Okay.
So so you're looking at $350 to begin, or if you're gonna set this up someplace where you have an Ethernet connection, it's just $300. I don't think this is the market that this is for is the people who are using Airport Express and Squeezebox and stuff like that and are finding it inadequate for what they want to do.
Right.
And the thing Sonos has done a really nice job with is getting on board with tons and tons of services. I mean, Pandora, LastFM, I think everything but Slacker and a couple of other smaller
services. And if I recall correctly, they support lossless compression too, right?
They support FLAC. I don't know if they support
– AC lossless.
Oh, they do support AC lossless. Yeah, so – I mean, that is a substantial difference because the Apple stuff, there's no easy way to stream.
Right.
You can stream AAC lossless. You can't stream FLAC.
Right.
And the nice thing about that is you don't need to run any kind of server software. Literally, you just point it at a network. If you have a large collection of RIP music, you point it at a network, at an SMB share.
Right.
You can even authenticate and it scans it and lets you browse just like you would on your iPhone or any other kind of modern music player.
Right. And they now have a controller app for the iPhone.
Yeah. So
– and do they have one for Android yet?
So they have Android, iPad native, and iPhone as well.
Right. Used to be you had to get this $300 thing that was just a little tablet basically, but now you don't need that anymore.
Well, so they've had two generations of that. The first one had the old iPhone iPod spinny
style.
Wheel.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which thinking back now, it's kind of funny.
That was a big innovation.
Wheel. Yeah.
Patents for that all over the place.
How quickly that was a prime driver for that product line and then immediately disappeared.
Oh, yeah.
And then they released a looks like an Android phone, basically, a kind of chunky Android phone. And I think that remote's still $350, something. It's kind of expensive. And completely unnecessary if right. everybody
you made the case that
phone.
The spinny wheel, the big one, was good. Like,
well, so but in a world before touchscreens, the spinny wheel was great because it was you could put as much music. The spinny wheel combined with an accelerated scroll like Apple uses and Sonos and a lot of other people did gave you access to massive music collections without having to.
Well, I'm saying the Sonos original Sonos remote.
Well, yeah,
period.
But that was a product that came out in, what, 2003 probably?
Right. Yeah, it's an old product. I mean, for the time, it was pretty neat.
Yeah. Dedicated big remote. It's not like that form factor.
Well, but I mean, you're thinking about taking your iPhone out of your pocket. Yeah. Before that, there was no – how would you control this if you didn't have a remote? There was no yeah. smartphone. Yeah. I mean, Windows Mobile, there was no – that wouldn't work. You could either fire up your PC and load it up that way or – I mean – This is a perfect example of how much has changed since the iPhone came out in 2007.
Well, even the iPads had an interesting impact on the market for whole house automation.
Yeah.
It used to be that what are the companies there now? I can't remember some.
Z-Wave and all those guys.
You know, they'd build your custom home theater system and all your speakers all over the house and stuff, and you'd have this thing that was a chunky tablet. That
yeah.
was and now they're all migrating to iPads.
Well, and the experience is a lot better because the capacitive touchscreen is much more responsive. And
right.
It's just a better experience all around. Do you have home automation stuff, Lloyd?
No.
Never?
I don't. My house isn't.
Doesn't require?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I'm 1,000 square feet in Northern California. I don't need.
I have a reasonably large house that's kind of compartmentalized, but, you know, it's more like our usage patterns don't really require it, right? Because we have, like, we watch TV in one room.
Yeah.
Music is where we happen to be because we all have players and stuff, and so it's not really needed.
Sprinklers need automation. That's it.
Yeah, systems. Right. That's the only thing that's in my house that's automated is my sprinkler system.
Well, the light switch in my kitchen conked out the other day. It didn't conk out, but it's one of those mechanical, the real soft tilt ones, and it's not locking. It's unreliably locking in place. So I went to Home Depot and I was looking at switches and it's a dimmer, so I wanted to get a dimmer. And I saw at the end of the aisle in the chump section a Z-Wave light switch. So I thought, I'm going to try this out. So I took it home and it's been sitting on my counter next to the light switch for the last 3 weeks. Because every time I think, oh, now would be a good time to do the light switch, it's dark outside and I don't want to have to kill power for the whole house, just to and then work by flashlight. So I think this Saturday is finally the day that I'm gonna do that.
As I told you before the podcast, we're looking at remodeling our entire kitchen.
Yeah,
and who knows what may change as we're buying this stuff for that.
Yeah, well, and the kitchen. So I mean, remodeling a kitchen is a traumatic experience in my.
There's a lot to consider.
Yeah.
In our house, we have to have the electrical updated, right? It was built in the mid-60s, so it's not to code.
So you have the center, the rod thing with the drop-down?
No. It's just two-wire polarized.
Oh, okay.
So that'll
be nice.
The current code, actually, for electrical in the kitchen, it's really weird. You have to have, like, outlets spaced out pretty close.
Well, the big deal is that everything either has to be
GFI
or it has to all be tied to a GFI.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, well, I did electrical work when I bought my house, and because you know it was a house that's built in the 50s,
right.
They did a remodel, but when they remodeled, I don't think they actually did permits and everything, so there weren't anywhere near enough outlets in the kitchen.
Where are you getting cabinets?
don't go there. Don't go there.
I can give recommendations.
Norm knows a guy. Later, but we're probably like. This close to picking a contractor.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Okay. And the contractor's going to do, pick the cabinets?
It's custom.
Oh, custom. Yeah. Wow, that's fancy.
So we'll see.
Well, also, here's a refrigerator thing we had.
Custom turns out not to be that much more expensive than pre-made.
Really?
Right.
Yeah, with the right people.
Right. And then you get exactly what you want instead of...
The little gap fillers and stuff like that.
I hate gap fillers.
Refrigerator. Will had a. I got a refrigerator that's similar to Will's, where the freezer is the drawer.
I hate the bottom tray freezer.
I love the bottom tray freezer.
Everything just ends up in piles down there. You can never.
I have two bottom trays.
I have two bottom trays too.
Yeah.
I don't like it for two reasons. One, the ice maker is down there.
Oh, okay.
I open the door, the dog is sitting there just eyeballing the ice tray.
Side by side. That's what we're going
for. Really?
That's what we have now, and that's what we're going to go for. Side by side.
Okay.
I like the wide side by side, but I don't. Do you have a freezer in the garage though?
I have a second refrigerator in the garage.
Okay.
That's the thing I need to do.
Like a top and bottom fridge in the garage is kind of what I'm thinking I'm going to do.
Or one of those chests.
And then depending upon, I'm going to actually put my power meter, my WhatsApp Pro on both refrigerators, and keep and when we replace the existing one in the kitchen, we're going to keep the one that uses the
latest. You're going to have a dual.
Power. Right.
I like that. I like that.
But yeah, side by side. I mean, that's what we have now. It's what we're used to, and it's easier to organize the freezer.
The only thing that's nice about having the top and bottom is at, like Thanksgiving when you're putting a partially eaten turkey carcass or something in the fridge. It makes it easy to get, you know, the side by side. You don't have.
Well, we're even going further than that in terms of restricting space because we have like I don't know how deep we have this gigantic Maytag thing, and we're going to countertop depth fridge.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
So that's like the wide.
They're not that wide. Okay. I mean, there's two kinds. There's the wide ones.
It's like the Sub-Zero kind,
which cost $1 million.
Yeah, they're really expensive.
And then there's actually just normal fridges that are countertop depth, but you're restricted to a max of like 24 cubic feet.
Okay. So minimalist fridge design.
Somewhat.
Okay.
Oh, speaking of which, did you see the tweet that I did? My daughter sent me a link to this weird – so this company I'm trying to remember the name of the company. They're big into the appliance business, right? And they hold this design contest every year, and they posted the results. And one of them is this weird fridge in which the entire front of the – is this refrigerated gel. And when you want to cool something, you just stick this thing into your food. Into
oh my
the gel.
God, that's awesome!
So it's kind of like when people do like well, they're snowed in. They open the door and put the beer in the snow.
That was right, the best part about living on the East Coast is you don't have to. There's no beer in the fridge all winter long. You just put it outside.
It was great. I mean, I'm not sure I'd ever want. I don't think it's space efficient.
Oh yeah,
but just the idea of sticking your hand in this green goopy gel
doesn't retrieve
your beer or whatever. It's just awesome.
It's got to get really gross after a while. Yeah, though,
Ziploc
right?
bags, like, a lot of Ziploc bags.
Like, well, no, just like dust from the house. So it's going to get all gooped in. Gross. The future. Mm. Norm, you had one more thing you were testing.
Yeah, so I was gone all last week for Comic-Con.
Oh, the lens rental.
Yes, and this is the best thing. I don't know why we've never done this. Borrowlenses.com.
Right.
Super.
So, especially for high-end lenses.
Full disclaimer, this is a friend of ours works here, Josh Norum, who is a former coworker of mine. I guess you were you know Josh, but you know Josh too, I'm sure.
Maybe.
I used to be reviews editor at MaxPC.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So I flew out Wednesday, and we decided Monday, like early morning or early afternoon, that maybe we should rent a lens because I'm using like a Canon 30D, you know. Not that great. It's okay. And the lens we have, it's not very good. It's a zoom lens.
It's a slow zoom lens.
It's a very slow zoom lens. And we just went to the website, found a lens. I got 24mm 1.4 and fixed. And they had it shipped to overnight to a local place where you pick it up. And it turned out to be
like it's in a my neighborhood. Shop in your neighborhood. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. I just went to the camera shop and picked it up and then returned it 1 week later.
Mm-hmm.
No hassle. It was $70 and got insurance and everything.
Well, the price depends on what lens you get. I mean, I was looking at renting an exotic and they can get pretty expensive.
When you say exotic, you mean like a
500mm. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
But that's a lens that if you wanted to buy, it'd be
$8,000, right? Yeah. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even so, my sister shoots horse shows on weekends. She shoots kids riding over horse jumps.
Shoots kids riding horses
with a camera.
Shoots horse.
Important distinction. And she uses them fairly right. Like when she goes someplace new and isn't sure what kind of lens she's going to need. She has a good medium range zoom, and then she has a kind of a big. It's not a crazy lens like that. Right. But it's one of the ones that's not black, it's tan.
Wow.
Yeah, and so she's rented from them before and has had a good experience. Yeah.
I mean, that's the thing. You don't need a really high end. You don't need a 70 or 5D Mark II or, you know, or 7000 to shoot good pictures.
Yeah, so if you want to see what the pictures that Norm took with the lens look like, go to Comic Vine
and check the perfect for web.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, this is something we don't talk about cameras a whole lot on the podcast. But the thing I was always told, and I haven't owned a SLR. I mean, I have an old film SLR, but I missed the digital transition and haven't jumped back in yet. The thing I always found was that much more important than the body you have, even in a digital age, the glass you buy is the most important thing. Mm-hmm. And I mean, you're shooting with a 5-year-old camera, and the pictures look great because you used good glass. So that'll do it for what we're testing. Let's wait. Lloyd, you brought show and tell stuff.
Yeah, I brought these two boxes in, and the name of the game is guess which one's the motherboard.
So we have to paint a word picture here.
Yeah, right. So anybody who's built their own PC knows that roughly the size of a motherboard box, especially if you get a high-end motherboard. It's sort of this double-wide box, with a handle on it.
Out. Yeah, you're talking about the ASUS ones.
Right.
Yeah, because a lot of the – if you go to like a Fry's and you get a regular motherboard box, it's
sometimes they're just in a white box.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, but the high-end ones that are the gaming boards.
You love the packaging.
Gigabyte's the same way, right? You got a handle on it.
Yeah.
And it looks like a small briefcase kind of made out of cardboard.
Yeah.
Well, so I brought one of these in, and then I brought a motherboard in. I brought a motherboard and a graphics card. Turns out that the motherboard is a fairly high-end motherboard, too, because it's part of ASUS's gaming series. Mm-hmm. It's a Z68 board. It's got all the bells and whistles for overclocking and all that jazz.
Uh-huh.
But it's a micro ATX board. So the graphics card box is the biggest box I've ever seen for graphics. It's a motherboard box. I mean, literally, it's one of those double-height motherboard boxes.
I think some of the GTX, some of the NVIDIA 5800 boards. 580s might have come in boxes this big, but...
Right.
This is crazy.
Yeah. And it's their overclocked GTX. What is it called? It's called the Matrix 580, right? And it's got two cooling fans on it and all that jazz. But I mean, I was just startled when
is it a 3-slot card or is it a 2-slot card?
It's theoretically like 2-slot. Yeah, probably.
Okay.
I'll have to try it out. I'm going to be reviewing this for Max PC, so we'll see.
Okay.
And the little Gene motherboard, it's called
Gene
Maximus 4 Gene. And it's their little micro ATX high-end gaming board. I'm going to be doing a build-it project for PC World for this. And it's just a neat little board. I've always liked the idea of a micro ATX high-end board. You know, you can get lots of micro ATX boards, but most of those are sort of like, you know, entry-level kind of boards.
Yeah.
And there's only a few companies, like ASUS is one of them, I think. Actually, I think ASUS is now the only one that sells a high-end micro ATX board.
So have you tested the Z68 SSD hybrid, like they're kind of weird motherboard hybridization stuff?
Benchmarking it? No, but I've had one running for just normal stuff for a while now.
So I haven't spent any time with this at all. How does that work? Does it show up as a single drive for Windows?
Yes.
Or, okay, so
you don't see the SSD at all.
Okay, so it's just using the SSD as kind of a big cache.
It's a cache, right? It's a giant cache.
Okay.
Now, when you bring up the little Intel RAID tool,
you
see it there.
So the matrix storage.
But when
thing
you pop up in Windows Explorer, you just see one drive.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And then when you turn it off. Everything that was in the cache stays there, mm-hmm. so that when you boot it back up, it assumes that.
So Windows boots with SSD speed, right. But you have. Well, I wish that was on my 1366 chipset. Right. That's something I'd actually use.
Yeah, it's a nice feature. Some people have reported problems with it, but the problems seem to be more with what SSD they choose rather than the Z68.
Oh, okay, and it seems like the kind of thing you could probably use a relatively small SSD.
That's the idea. In fact, I think the maximum size supported is like 100 gig.
Okay, so they wanted to sell ADMs,
right?
X80Ms.
Right.
Okay, interesting. So that'll be in Max PC at some point in the not-too-distant future, mm-hmm. I assume, though. Cool. Let's play the music and then answer some questions. Here's the first question.
Hey, Gary, Will, Anna, Norm, or anyone else in the tested family on the show today. My name is John. I have a quick question regarding virtual backups. I recently had both my internal hard drive and my external hard drive go within a week of each other and lost quite a bit of data, but nothing too important, thank God for the cloud and Google Docs. I'm just curious if there are any services for Windows users that back up data to a virtual drive that you'd recommend. As for our hometown trivia, I'm from St. Augustine, Florida, which happens to be the oldest city in the nation, founded in 1565, about 40 years before the English settled Jamestown. So take that, Gary. Thanks for your help and keep on testing.
There's a fort in St. Augustine built out of seashells.
Okay.
They put stacked seashells together and then use something to cement them together. And it's this yellow, weird – it's really cool. I remember it's a very distinct childhood memory of mine going to the fort in St. Augustine and seeing how the Spaniards built forts in the 1600s. But
when he says virtual drive, does he mean cloud backup?
I assume he means cloud backup. I assume he's talking about a Mozy or Carbonite or one of those things. I've used Mozy for a long time. We haven't actually reviewed any of these because it's kind of a hard thing to review. But I use Mozy to back up my photos and documents folder, and it's worked very well for me so far. Do you guys use anything? Dropbox, for important files?
Well, I use Dropbox for some smaller important files, just the free version.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's what I use Dropbox for that kind of stuff as well. We have, in fact, actually all of our like tested – I think that's our repository for all of our tested materials, like from benchmarks to like logos and stuff like that.
Things like my gigantic array of raw photos and stuff like that get backed up about once a week to the Windows home server.
Okay.
And then the Windows home server about once a week backs itself up to an external drive that's plugged in permanently to
That's I do the same thing with my home server stuff.
Right.
But I also have the home Mozy running on the home server, so it updates to there.
Well, you said it actually launched a Dropbox competitor this week.
Yeah, right.
So you send it.
Yeah. Yeah.
It seemed a little feature limited, though.
It does, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like if you don't want to use Dropbox, then Windows Live is probably the SkyDrive stuff is a little more interesting.
Yeah, it's about the same amount of free space. Dropbox is nice, up to like 9 gigs or something.
You have to really work to get 9 gigs on Dropbox.
Work to get referrals. They're expanding a lot, though. I think they just bought at least some office space in the city, and they're going to expand to 400 employees. So once they get over that PR problem with the security, because I've had a bunch of people come say they don't trust Dropbox anymore because of that security issue.
I mean, my feeling on Dropbox is anything that you feel you don't want to. It's like email. Don't send anything in email that you don't want everyone in the world to know about, right? I feel the same way about Dropbox. If you're worried about it, encrypt the files on but I find that using something like TrueCrypt or Perfect Disk or something like that on Dropbox has very mixed results, because every time there's a change to the file, it uploads the whole thing, not just the diff. So you end up with spending a lot of time upload, especially if you have a big encrypted file. And you make one change inside that volume, then it uploads the whole thing again, and it's kind of a mess. So Mozy, Carbonite, there's a bunch of services that do this kind of stuff. The important thing I find when you're evaluating that stuff is to actually test out during the trial period how the restore works. You're not going to back up your whole hard drive to this to these cloud services just because the upstream for most users is really bad.
Yeah. Especially like you talk about Google Music, people just uploading their music collections.
Yeah. Well, and the other thing that's important is if you have bandwidth limitations from your ISP, whether it's AT&T with 150 gigabyte cap or Comcast with a 250 gigabyte cap, this counts. Upstream counts. It's not just downstream. So
I didn't know that.
Yeah, no, they don't really publicize that very well. So it's a good idea before you start to, if you're running a router that you can put DDWRT or Tomato or something on, then you can do a bandwidth monitor on that and know where you're at. Or alternately, just go someplace that there's fast upstream, like perhaps your workplace, and do your uploads from there. Not that I
don't endorse that.
Encourage people to steal bandwidth from their workplace. Yeah. But you're not going to want to do media. You're not going to want to do video. You may not want to do photos if you're shooting a lot of RAW. You're probably going to need to use that for documents and like your selected important photos.
Hey, Tested Crew. My name's Chris and I'm from England. I have a question for you guys, more about places rather than objects that you've tested. I have to do a year abroad as part of my degree in the States, and I was wondering if you guys could recommend like towns or cities that, within California that are good to attend. I'll attach a full list of all the universities I can go to, but the only school I can go to on the West Coast is is all the UC campuses. So I just want your opinions on places like, Los Angeles, San Diego, Berkeley, etc.
Oh, I have opinions about that.
As for hometown trivia, I'm from a town called Weybridge in Surrey, and the clubhouse of the golf club that I'm a member at is actually the building within which Barnes Wallace designed the bouncing bomb. So it's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool.
Weird as well. Anyway, thank you for the great podcast. Keep testing.
So we talked about the bouncing bomb a few weeks on the podcast, but that's the thing that they skipped the bomb
dam
up
busters,
the river.
Right?
Yeah, the dam busters.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. That's pretty cool.
Watch your language, Lloyd. This is a family-friendly podcast.
All right.
Here's the list. It's State University of New York at Buffalo, the Pennsylvania State University, University of Kansas, Marquette University of Wisconsin, North Carolina at Charlotte, Purdue, University of South Carolina, Tennessee at Knoxville, University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, and University of Miami.
Didn't he say University of California?
And he said the UCs.
And the UCs,
for West Coast. Yeah.
I mean, I have opinions about the UCs.
I graduated from Tennessee. It's not the best place to get a taste of America, but it's a fun place to go to school for a year.
If you want to come out to the UCs for the California experience, pick one of the coastal UCs.
So Santa Cruz. San Diego.
Well, that's one of them. Or LA. Or San Diego. I mean, those are all good. Berkeley, kind of intense. Depends on what you want to do, but it's a good school.
Depends on the program you're going
right,
into.
Right.
Well, Norm went to Berkeley.
I liked it.
Yeah. Yeah. But you did some kind of bogus, like not computer science.
Yeah. Cognitive science.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The rhetoric. CS.
Yeah. Bullshitting.
And one of my daughters is at UCLA in the physics department there, and she likes it. But she likes UCLA, but not so much LA, I guess.
Right.
That's what a lot of people say.
UCLA is in a really nice part of town, and it's like the campus is nice.
And it's close to Santa Monica, which is actually, if you want, again, the California experience.
Right.
You
go, yeah,
the California experience is, it's very loaded. Like, what does California experience mean, though? It means different things for a lot of different people.
Well, I thought there were roller coasters and bears is what I got from, Disney told me.
Beaches and what you know from Katy Perry music videos and...
That's right. Sort of what I was leading to. I mean, if you want a more like authentic California experience, you can always go to Davis.
We take the dog to Davis. The dog's dermatologist is at Davis. It is it's an ag school, man. It's that is the thing that strikes me about Davis.
Back to sort of what is the neatest architecture I've seen on a UC campus? It's actually not one of the big schools. It's UC Irvine.
Oh, okay.
Irvine has neat architecture and some of the buildings that they built there.
Is it in the valley?
No, it's close to the coast. Okay. It's near it's near John Wayne Airport.
Okay.
And,
so Orange County.
Right. Okay. And the architecture is really cool. And the other kind of weird claim to fame, the nerdy claim to fame it has, is that one of the dorm complexes is named after all the Middle Earth locations.
Oh, wow. That is super nerdy. I mean, here's the thing. No matter how long you're here for, just plan to take some time at the end and either
and travel
and do some traveling, because the best way to see this country is to get in a car or take a series of short flights and just go all over and be prepared to explore. Yes.
I mean, the United States is no more culturally homogeneous than the UK is, which is quite diverse. So,
right.
You want to travel. Give yourself some time to travel around.
Exactly. And we have one more question. Here it is.
Hey there, Norm, Will, and Gary. This is Mr. Plaid from the forums.
Sorry, also Lloyd.
Nick from Columbia, South Carolina. My question – oh, hometown trivia, sorry. Amazon is building a distribution center right down the road from me. I guess that counts. So I'll get my Clif Bars and toilet paper overnight. Yay. My question is about netbooks. I have a netbook. I got one when everybody else was getting netbooks, and like most people – now, I don't use my netbook that much because I've got an iPad and a Chromebook. Are there any ways I can use my netbook, like as a media server or any other kind of weird server that I might not be thinking of? It's just sitting there gathering dust. I'd like to use it for something other than a doorstop or a paperweight. That's all. Thanks for the show. Love what you guys do. Keep on getting tested. I love you. Bye.
Getting tested is a little different than always being testing. So this is a good question. I know that there are a lot of orphan netbooks out there.
Yeah, like people couldn't return them fast enough.
Donate.
You donate to a school is good.
Yeah.
The other thing, I know some people are putting them in their living room and using them. If you have one of the netbooks that's fast enough to do Hulu and stuff like that with, you can do Netflix and Hulu on them. I know that that's limited, especially if you got bought one of the early generation netbooks. But schools, they're great for kids. If you need to write a paper or something like that, a netbook is awesome and good battery life and relatively indestructible.
Plus, can't run too many of those web games.
Yeah,
like then the kids don't go on a WoW or
right. Yeah. So talk to your school system and see where they can use them, or if you have a nephew or niece or child or something, pass it on. So that'll do it for questions this week. As always, if you have questions, the email is podcast@tested.com. Keep the questions short, under a minute. We like the shorter questions more. And have never said no to a little hometown trivia. Norm, which file format should you never, ever submit a question in?
WMA.
That is correct, sir. And, of course, use a microphone if you're recording on your phone or in your car or something like that.
Levelator.
Yeah, Levelator is good, too. And that'll do it for us this week. Thanks for coming in, Lloyd. It's been good to have you here.
Been fun.
Yeah, we'll have to get you in here. You and Gary can have a yelling off at some point.
Oh, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, and Norm and I will be back next week. I think Gary is Gary's on location this week. He's working. He's doing the job that he gets paid for right now. So he's thinking he'll probably be back next week. But we'll of course keep you guys posted on that. And as always, stay tuned for Fake Outtakes.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
Tested.
Silver Chan, do you have a pulse?
98 beats a minute.
That's way too high.
Tested.
There have been miniatures on the desk between you and I, Lloyd, this entire podcast, and I would like to discuss them.
Are they like Hallmark miniatures?
No, these are for the TV geeks in the audience. These are actually movie geeks. There's the Starship Enterprise and a Klingon battlecruiser. The Enterprise in particular is the Enterprise from the recent movie,
not from
the TV show.
Yeah.
J.J. Abrams' design.
Yeah, right, slightly more streamlined looking. These are miniatures that are from – they have little click base on them. Have you ever played the WizKids games with the
Hero click base?
HeroClix. HeroClix is an example. But these came inside of a game called Star Trek Expeditions. This is a cooperative board game designed by Rainer Knizia. And it's just a board – but it comes with a cool set of miniatures. It comes with the two Starship miniatures plus miniatures of the four primary characters, Uhura, Bones,
Kirk,
and, of course, Spock.
Is it modeled after the new actors, right?
Well, theoretically, it's all the new actors, but you can't really tell. But let's just say that the Starship miniatures are much better rendered than the people miniatures.
Well, you know, from years of using the MakerBot, we found that things are easier than people.
Right.
People always look really scary.
Right.
So this is a co-op game, though.
Right.
And is it? Are you fighting against Nero?
No, it's actually not a movie story. It's sort of a made up story where you're basically trying to convince this planet to join the Federation and not the Klingons. That's sort of the backstory.
The pre-warp or post-warp?
You know, it doesn't say in the thing.
It must be post, unless
it has to be
post-warp.
Well, because it's got Kirk and the Enterprise, right? So it's got to be post-warp.
But was that the planet pre-warp or post-warp? Is it before the Prime Directive or after the Prime Directive?
That's a good question.
That's an expansion, Norm.
Yeah.
Whichever
because
one
Kirk
it is
really
it
didn't
now.
Care for that. I don't think there was a Prime Directive.
At any rate, then. So you're basically solving this mystery. There's three sets of mysteries along the way. They call them missions, but they're little mysteries that you uncover. And there's some variation in the game. But what I think my guess is from playing it once is it has probably about 7 or 8 plays before you want an expansion.
Okay.
Because by then you will probably have seen all the cards.
Okay. And have a good idea of how the mechanic works
and all that. Right.
Yeah, so it's worth mentioning. Norm and I are pretty well-established board game geeks. Gary is anti-board games, it turns out.
No, Gary loves board games.
I don't know.
He played the high school one.
Oh, that game's bad, too. High school drama.
High school drama. He loves the drama. He loves the role-playing.
He likes drama.
He likes the role-playing.
Right. But he didn't like Ticket to Ride at all, which he's the first person I've ever met who didn't like Ticket to Ride.
That's like a gateway drug.
I know. Who doesn't like Ticket to Ride? Have you played the iPad version of that, by
yes.
the way?
Yes. It's nicely done.
I thought it was really well done. Yeah. So Lloyd's a board game geek too, and
big time.
Yeah.
Bigger than we are.
Yeah,
I think.
I
host a board game meetup once a month at my house.
I've got to come. I've got to come on Sundays.
Even though it meets in Sunnyvale, it's called the Mountain View Board Gamers, I think, or something like that. If you do
I'm out then.
Anyway, yeah, all right. Anyway, yeah,
truth we in geography.
Quite a variety of games from sort of really quick card games up through. I remember one time going. So they typically last seven or eight hours, right? One session. And one time, one group started the old Advanced Civilization. You remember the old Avalon Hill game?
Yeah, yeah.
Another group started the new version of Sid Meier's Civilization.
Uh-huh.
And a third group started, I can't remember what game it was. Anyway, we ended up playing, each group ended up playing that one game for the entire 7 hours. But most of the time, we go through 2 or 3 different games in a session.
Okay. I mean, and you mix up the tables so different people get to play. And,
yep.
I mean, you said you had like 16, 17 people show up sometimes.
Right.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So this is out now, I'm assuming, since we have
it's
here.
Almost worth getting just for the miniatures because they're pretty neat. But it really, again, you have to be into co-op games, first of all. It's not competitive.
So I assume that the Klingon battlecruiser is kind of the ticker that represents
No, actually,
the enemy.
What happened, that's like almost a little side thing that's going on. What you want to do is the Enterprise, there's with co-op games, there's one winning condition typically and many losing conditions, right? One of the losing conditions is that if your Enterprise is destroyed, then you lose.
Okay.
Makes sense.
And so – but if you destroy – successfully beat the Klingons, you don't win.
Wait. It didn't – Enterprise was destroyed in
– Search for Spock.
Search for Spock.
Enterprise.
Okay.
In this game.
All right.
Okay.
This Enterprise has never been destroyed yet.
Okay.
Yeah, right. And so that's one of the losing conditions.
Okay.
But if you beat the Klingon and destroy the Klingon battlecruiser, you don't automatically win. There's a few other – there's a few different winning conditions.
So it's like Pandemic or Forbidden Island or one of those type things.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there is a ticker that kind of randomly counts down, and if that expires, then you also lose, and so on.
So we were talking about Power Grid before the show.
Right.
For my birthday, one of the things Gina got me was Power Grid. We've been playing that and the new Dominion expansion, which I guess isn't that new anymore, but the Prosperity one.
Right.
You're a Dominion player,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And I quite like Power Grid because it ends up just because of the game changes its nature into the different phases of the game.
Right.
You know, it goes from being a territory control game to an economy game, I guess, to an economy game.
Right.
And is works pretty well with two players, which is unusual for that kind of scope game. We've had a easy time finding a bunch of card games that are good with two players, but there's not a ton of kind of big, you know, lots of pieces. Exciting, you know. Part of the reason I like board games is that there's a
does
lot of stuff
like,
going on.
Like games that involve combat or not?
You mean like kind of dice throw games?
No, like board games that require.
She's very competitive. Yeah.
Okay. Okay.
So we don't generally co-op games. We don't play co-op games unless there's a lot of people around.
But she likes competitive games.
She likes
Battleship
competitive games.
Galaxies.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll give it a try.
It was designed by the same guy that designed HeroQuest.
Okay.
That?
Yeah. Yeah.
The little miniatures game.
Yeah.
And it comes with like this. I don't know. Like 18 starship miniatures on this big space board, and it's like, but and although it's a very tactical board game, it's tactical light, so you're not, it's not Battleship in the sense of,
it's not like a turn-based strategy game.
It is a little bit,
okay,
but it's light, you know.
Okay, right? I'll take a look at it. Yeah.
And they're trying to get out and they're trying to leverage the old Battleship where you
C-73,
right.
Yeah,
but it's not like that at all.
Okay. Well, we play a fair amount. Like in the Dominion world, we end up playing much more Intrigue than the original Dominion, right, just because it's kind of more back and forth, and there's an opportunity to screw over your significant other.
Have you played Race for the Galaxy?
I have played Race for the Galaxy. Okay. We played Race for the Galaxy with Viderman once.
Okay,
That's the one where the game changes really dramatically based on the cards you draw. Right.
Right.
Yeah. That to me, that game seemed unnecessary. It seemed like it was overly random.
Well, I think that you can – once you set a strategy, you can – if you get a couple of the expansions, it kind of it reduces the randomness because there's more and more stuff that allows you to search the deck and stuff like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it just had like crazy swings that were totally at the whim of the
– My biggest problem with that game initially – I think it's a lot of fun, but initially was there's 47 different icons on a single card.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Figure out what they all mean. Once you do, I have a great time with that one too.
Norm, you guys are playing board games at Norm Manor these days.
Just Dominion and expansions.
Dominion and expansions.
Yeah.
And the other game that I'll give a shout out to is a game called Innovation.
Okay.
It's a $20 card game.
Okay.
Kind of a the
loose. You were telling me about this before the show. Yeah.
The loose theme is a civilization building game, but really it's a screw with your neighbor game.
Oh, that sounds great.
And it's one of those games where the rules are like three pages, but everything's really on the cards. Right?
Okay.
So it's really fun.
So the Star Trek game is like 3-4 players.
Yeah, you want to have it's
a big room.
Theoretically, you can, it maxes out at 4 players.
Okay.
And it says you can play with fewer players, but then what really happens is that some players run multiple characters. You really have to have 4 characters.
So it's like the zombie game. Not zombies, but the other one. Last Night on Earth.
Oh, yeah, right.
And then Innovations?
Innovation, 2-4 players. Better with 2 or 3 than 4, though.
Okay, good to know.
4 players game, suddenly the time expands by like 4x.
And I think Power Grid goes up to 4 people as well, but I've only played it with 2 and 3. So
you guys play the Adventurers?
I played the Adventurers with you.
That's a great beer and pretzels game.
Yeah.
It's a push your luck kind of game.
Yeah, it's making poor decisions constantly. Yeah. The setup on that is that it's basically like the opening scene of Raiders of the Lost Ark, where
you got to run away from the boulder and get out of the cave. As much loot as you can.
Yeah, but the catch is, you know, every time you pick up loot, it takes time, right?
Right.
And you don't have much time in the game. So the winner is not just the person who gets the most loot, but it's the person who gets out alive with the most loot.
And frequently it's the only person who got out alive in our
games. Take the waterfall route and shortcuts.
There's an Adventurers 2 coming out. You know that.
Oh, no, I didn't know that. My only complaint with that game was that it was a little bit like traditional board gamey.
Mm-hmm.
Like Candy, like I'm going to say Candyland, but I don't really mean Candyland.
Life or something.
Yeah.
It was linear.
It's very linear. It seems like it's very much the same each time. Yeah.
But it's just fun. That's why it's good. You know, beer and pretzels.
Beer and pretzels is a good description there. Anything else going on we want to talk about?
Comic-Con was amazing. Aside from photos, we shot a couple videos.
You shot 1,143 photos this year?
1,143 photos of cosplayers.
That's a lot of cosplay pictures.
Yes, a lot of cosplay pictures.
Hold on. We got to talk about this because I've had the privilege of watching you do the cosplay photo thing. And I don't know if you've ever – are you a Comic-Con guy? Have you been to Comic-Con?
No.
Okay.
No.
So you know, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, there's a bunch of people dressing up in really amazing costumes.
I should
costumes
say that I've been to science fiction conventions, so okay. It doesn't vary much in that regard.
I think the difference is the density of people.
Right.
Because at Comic-Con, you kind of can't – there's significant portions of the show that you can't really walk through.
Death lanes.
So Norm – when Norm is on with the camera, he has the camera in one hand with the strap wrapped around his arm, and he literally is – like his head is on a swivel looking for – people with good costumes, mm-hmm. and then he'll shout them down. He'll say, "Hey, Batman! You know, you over there, Batman."
No, never you over there. You have to know their names,
well,
otherwise
you have to
you can't
know the character.
Say girl with blonde hair.
Right.
You had to say, you know, "Hey, Harley Quinn from Batman: Arkham Asylum."
Right. So Norm will shout them down. They're moving in big packs. So Norm will take a couple of group
photos.
There's
a strategy. The convention floor is massive, and I have a route that I go.
It's a loop.
A loop that goes clockwise.
It's like a route through a first-person shooter.
and I do the loop at least 10 times each day, and then I do twice the other direction in case someone also is doing the loop and I miss them. And so I do the lobby loop and then inside the convention hall and then loop around.
There's a real strategy.
He's like the character from Beyond Good and Evil. In.
He really is, yeah. Yeah, so it's – but the way you kind of cut – you divide and conquer. So you start out with the big group pictures, and then you'll cut people out one at a time until you get single shots of everybody.
You can take one good group picture, which is great, or you can split off and get three great single pictures.
Or do both.
Or do both.
Yeah.
There's also strategies. Sometimes the really nice costumes are being held up because everyone wants to take photos. You don't need to necessarily take them first because you know they'll be there for the next 30 seconds. But if someone's walking away, get them first and then come back to the hold-up group.
So
lots of micromanagement.
I've been your spotter before for this, which is an incredibly high-stress job.
Oh, yeah. I can't hang out with anyone during the show because I'm talking to someone.
You're a nightmare.
And then I'm running off and then come back. Let's continue the conversation.
So then
– this sounds like the topic for like a lightweight board game or card game.
It could be actually. Yeah. It would actually – I think it would actually work. So as the spotter, my job was while Norm was taking pictures of one person to find the next picture in line and get them queued up so that Norm could literally finish taking his pictures and walk away with no acknowledgement whatsoever, kind of being a dick. Let's be perfectly honest. And then just start doing the exact same thing over and over again.
Yep.
8 or 10 hours a day for 3 or 4 days.
4 days, yep.
So you can see this in action.
So do you go to Comic-Con for anything other than cosplay?
I used to. This year, I did not.
Norm used to go to Comic-Con for fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, sorry, Norm. You're going to PAX for – we're going to be at PAX for
I'm going
fun
to PAX for
this
fun.
Year. Yeah. We're paying our own way. We're not working except for the panel.
Oh, it was the hardest – I had to shoot this video with on. It's a video that hasn't gone up yet about the five most – the most expensive, rarest collectibles at Comic-Con. I can talk a little about that in a second. But I told on, okay, we have a two-hour block from 10 a.m. to 12 noon that we're going to shoot this video. And
that's it.
And it took every bit of my not considerable willpower to not take photos during those 2 hours.
Oh, yeah.
Like, the cap was on.
Wait.
The thing is, it's 150,000 people. And so if you miss out on a good photo, it's all about timing.
Yeah.
You're likely never going to see that person ever again, and you're going to miss out on a good photo.
Right. And it's about maximizing your chances to find the good photo.
Yeah.
But there's footage of you doing this.
There's a small footage.
in one of the daily wrap-ups. Is it the day one wrap-up, I think?
Day two wrap-up.
Yeah, so if you want to see that, if you want to see Norm at his dickishest, go for it. Watch that there.
So in terms of collectibles, Star Trek fans, this company called Quantum Mechanics, they have a license for the new Star Trek movie for props and stuff. They sell with Bad Robot, the production company for Star Trek. So I have like a phaser from them, but they also do this artisan line of like ship replicas. They have the new starship,
the Hot Rod one,
which came out. They debuted it at Comic-Con 2 years ago. It's still not for sale yet. It's like $5,000.
Wow!
For this massive replica. This year they debuted the original Enterprise from the movie, motion picture, NCC-1701.
The flat,
narrow nacelles. Amazing. You can actually – it's incredibly detailed, has lights up and everything. It's on this really cool base of the mirror. You can actually look inside the shuttle bay and they have like little like shuttles and people inside. It's like almost like a little diorama.
Wow.
You can see the turbo lift where Kirk
goes
up.
How big is this?
It's about like this big.
Like, I mean, four, like
four feet?
Feet
long.
Yeah. People on the podcast can't see you hold your
feet,
arms
yeah.
apart.
Yeah.
Where would you put that? That seems like – that A seems a little bit like Lady Repellent.
Well,
I mean, that seems like I could get away with that because I'm married and happily so, and my wife tolerates a lot of nonsense. But I think that you have to have a special kind of girl come home and see that and be like, oh, wow, I think it's awesome that you have a $5,000 Starship Enterprise model in your living room.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I guess if you can afford that.
Did you pre-order one?
No, I did not pre-order one. Okay. They're only making, I think, 300, and they sold like 100 of them already.
Wow.
But the coolest thing at Comic-Con that I got to hold was Zorg Industries ZF-1, the gun from The Fifth Element.
The actual Gary Oldman gun.
Yes, yeah. The one that he sells in the crates, you know, zero stone, zero crates.
Right.
They made six of those for the movie. Each one did a separate thing because they were functional. And the one I got to hold was the working flamethrower version that Gary Oldman held in that one scene when he's demoing it. It is incredible.
Was it heavy?
It was totally heavy. Yeah.
Really? Did you get to fire the flamethrower?
No, it wasn't plugged in, but there was like a nozzle that you can connect a tube for gas and actually shoot flames.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Amazing prop.
It's in the video, right?
It's in the video.
It's coming soon.
Out. Yeah.
Cool. Well, I guess that does it for us this week. Lloyd, anything else?
Not that I can think of.
Let's go have some kimchi burritos, guys.
Oh, delicious.
Yes.
Delicious burritos.